Okay, what do we have here? Here's some candy canes for you.
Candy canes? Don't you mean candy corn?
Yeah.
Hey, it's a tough economy, kid. The price of candy corn has gone up. These candy canes are from Christmas last year. They're still good. Here's one for you. One for you.
Lame.
And one for you. Oh, wait a minute here. We have ourselves a little John Cena for Halloween.
You can't see me.
Uh-huh, cute. Very cute. So you're a little member of the C-Nation, huh?
Yeah.
So, is your mommy letting you watch Hell in a Cell tonight?
Uh-huh.
And who do you think is going to win the match between John Cena and Randy Orton?
John Cena! He's going to be the champion again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's just what I thought.
Hey, what are you doing? Those are our candy canes.
Not anymore, they're not.
Welcome to the 2014 Halloween edition of the Sala Monster Sounds Off, and now here's your host with the most, the Sala Monster.
Ah, it's the annual Halloween episode, my favorite. Are you ready, Zombie Sala Monster? You're watching Hell in a Cell tonight?
I'm a decomposing corpse. I don't watch television.
Yeah, but you do this podcast.
Well, are you going to pay me to watch Hell in a Cell like you pay me to do this podcast?
Well, no.
Then I think we're done here.
All right, thank you, Zombie Sala Monster. We will see you again next year. This is episode 351 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 26, 2014. I am the Sala Monster. Thank you, as always, for downloading or streaming the podcast, wherever you're listening, on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, or iTunes. We have some fun stuff planned here. We're going to go through Hell in a Cell predictions. We're going to talk a little bit about Raw from this past week, NXT, some TNA, and get into a bunch of your mailbag questions. And I may have some thoughts at the end. Nothing spoilerish, but some thoughts on See No Evil 2 here in the spirit of Halloween. I saw Kane's new movie, and I'll have some thoughts on that a little bit later on. But right now I want to get to some PayPal shout-outs for those of you who have donated to the show this week. I want to thank Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Gerald Battleaxe Broussard, and the Marvelous Savage, Leon Simmons, for donating to the Sound Off. You can do so on thesalamonster.com. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Whatever, you know, you want to give, it's up to you guys. That's just your way of supporting the podcast. There's a lot of different ways to show your support. You can also sign up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service using our custom URL, which is audibletrial.com/salamonster. We've had a couple of signups this week. We have another week left before the month is out, and I want to try to boost that a little bit here for October. So now would be a good time to punch in that custom URL if you haven't already done so. Sign up. It doesn't cost you anything. You get a free trial. You get one free audio book, no matter what, that you get to keep, whether you stick with the service beyond the 30 days or not. Tons of wrestling books up there, but it doesn't have to be a wrestling book. It could be whatever you want. You can search their library, over 150,000 titles. It's a good deal, and you get something free out of it. So what's not to like? Audibletrial.com/Salamonster. Also want to mention that we have some new shirts up on ProWrestlingTees.com in our official store. I mentioned last week the new kind of Raw theme shirt, Saturday Night's Main Event theme shirt. Those have been popular so far. There's also another new shirt I have not posted about yet, but I will either later today or tomorrow. Kind of a takeoff of the Run DMC logo, only this time it's Run SND for the Sound Off. So head over there and check that out. I think you might like it. ProWrestlingTees.com/SalaMonsterSoundsOff. I think our store has been doing pretty damn well, and I thank you guys for your support there. And I also want to mention, I mean, I'm in promotion mode here, and I'm sure a lot of you have already seen the link, but for those of you who have not, I posted a nearly 90-minute long sound-off extra, which is like a bonus sound-off on our YouTube channel. If you head over to youtube.com/thesalamonster, that will take you to our channel. Please subscribe while you are there. It's my interview with Aubrey Sitterson, host of the Straight Shoot Wrestling Podcast. Aubrey's a pretty interesting guy. He's had a pretty fun background. He's worked for Marvel Comics, DC, a bunch of other comic companies, as well as WWE. He's also worked for THQ and 2K, doing work on the WWE games. So he's a pretty interesting guy, very nice guy. And we had you know, a very enlightening conversation, I think you'll find. We had some disagreements, especially on the subject of titles in WWE these days. His philosophy is very different than mine, and we'll just leave it at that. But an enlightening conversation nonetheless, I thought, about a variety of different subjects, including Hell in a Cell tonight. We did predictions for the pay-per-view. I'm going to run through mine again here in a second. Hit the subscribe button when you're over there, because tomorrow afternoon I'm planning on getting up my Hell in a Cell review as a sound-off extra on YouTube. I don't get to do those post-pay-per-view reviews too often because of my day job. But I'm on vacation this week, and so what better way to spend my vacation than doing more work? And remember, you can always download the MP3 version of these reviews when they go up. Just check the video description, and you'll find the direct link in there. People still ask me, oh, is the audio version of this up? You're going to, you know, put like an MP3, you're going to push it out. The link is always in the description of these videos whenever I do them. These shows do not push to Podbean, which means they don't push to iTunes, they don't go to Stitcher, TuneIn, because they are intended to be just that, extras. That's why they're called Sound Off Extra. And I want to drive as much traffic as I can to the YouTube channel, but you can still download the audio versions if you listen to them on the go. If you want to listen to them on the go, that's up to you. You can just go to the video, and that's where you have to grab the link from. I also picked up a pretty good headset microphone this week for use on these extras whenever I decide to interview people like I did with Aubrey. And I think it worked out well. I was pleased with the quality. It's never going to be what you hear here because for whatever reason this microphone I use mutes all the other sound on my computer whenever I use it, so it's impossible for me to use this mic when I do interviews, for example, if I'm talking to somebody via Skype. I have no idea why it does that. It's very frustrating, but I can't use it for that purpose, so I went out and I bought a mic. You know, again, I'm a stickler for quality. It's very important to me, as you can tell when you listen to the show every single week. So it was a good investment. Say you say your PayPal dollars, hard at work. So anyway, check out that video, share it, leave some comments, leave some love, let me know what you think. I will be a panelist on Aubrey's Straight Shoot podcast tomorrow night, actually, immediately following Monday Night Raw. Head over to AubreySitterson.com, that's his official website for all the details. He does a live podcast after Raw Monday nights. It airs on YouTube via Google Hangout. Yes, this will be my first Google Hangout. So for those of you who have been dying to see a Solomonster video podcast, this is about as close as you're going to get, so if you want to tune in live for that, that'll be tomorrow night. Again, the links, all the details are on his website. I'll probably tweet them out too tomorrow. If you can't tune in live, don't worry about it. It's going to be archived on YouTube after the fact. And then it'll hit Stitcher and iTunes as well if you want to listen to an audio version of it. I will be on the show along with one of the top writers for Marvel Comics, Jason Aaron. I'm looking forward to it. Before we get into Hell in a Cell, got to talk about Elimination Chamber. This is a big story that broke yesterday. The Elimination Chamber pay-per-view is no more. This comes according to Mets fan on Reddit, who used to write for the SmackDown brand. He claims WWE has dropped the pay-per-view in favor of a new show in February called Fastlane. What a shit name. Who comes up with these pay-per-view names is what I would like to know. Remember Over the Limit? Oh my God, just bring back No Way Out. Crying out loud. The mindset here is that with only one WWE World Champion, there's really no need for the Elimination Chamber match anymore. You know, in my opinion, there was never a need to have the Elimination Chamber every single year. I like the move. I think it's a good move. And I say get rid of Hell in a Cell next. And then TLC after that. You know, tonight's pay-per-view should be called Halloween Havoc, not Hell in a Cell. I cannot for the life of me understand why they never bothered to use that name. Of all the WCW pay-per-view names, I probably only would have used two or three of them. That would have been at the top of my list, and I just can't believe they never took advantage of that. Hell in a Cell is tonight from Dallas, Texas, live on the WWE Network, and two matches on that show, in my opinion. Maybe more, maybe a third. I know Aubrey thinks there's a third, John Cena versus Randy Orton, but I think there are two other matches on this show that could easily steal the show, and I expect one of them to, Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins and Dolph Ziggler and Cesaro. I think it's their time to shine. I said this on the show I did with him. You know, hopefully the right people are paying attention, and when the night is over, their stock will have been elevated even higher. But my take on the show, not that it's a two-match show, but because of those two matches in particular, the Hell in a Cell with Rollins and Ambrose and the Intercontinental title match, two out of three falls, it makes Hell in a Cell a must-see show. And I know WWE has been very hit or miss with their shows lately, but we're talking Raw. You know, Raw, for the most part, has not been good. And on some weeks, Raw has been downright insufferable. And then every now and then, like this past week, there'll be a good show or a decent show. But by and large, I think people are just very disillusioned with the current product. But, you know, let's look at some of the recent pay-per-views. I mean, the pay-per-views usually end up doing pretty good. You know, there's some really good action on them. SummerSlam, Night of Champions, those weren't bad shows. So when I look at this card up and down, top to bottom, I don't see a bad card. I see a strong card on paper with at least two matches that could really end up being very memorable. So I think, again, for that reason, I'm looking forward to this show a lot. Now, what I want to do here, I want to go through the card really quickly. I know many of you already watched the video that I did on YouTube, the Sound Off Extra, so you know my basic predictions, but I want to run through things a little bit here, maybe give some extra thoughts. And this is the order that I think that the show will be in. So if I had to predict a match order, I'm going to go through the predictions here in the order I think the show will go. I think the show opens with the 2 out of 3 falls match between Ziggler and Cesaro. And if it doesn't, I think it's a mistake, because I think those two guys opening the show with the kind of match that they're capable of having, that's how you want to start a show. I think these guys could get things off with a bang. They've got a couple of title, actually a few different title matches on this show. You want to spread them out a little bit. I would open with this, and I think they will. I'm going with Dolph Ziggler. I think that Ziggler has lost so many times on television recently. He's had good matches. It's not as though he's looked bad, but he goes out there. He's the champion, right? He's got a belt, and he gets pinned every single week, cleanly in the middle of the ring. And aside from Cesaro, at least, you know, thank God him and Cesaro had a match on Monday night. Cesaro beat him. That resulted in a championship match on SmackDown Friday. And now here we are with what will probably be the blow-off to the feud. At least that makes sense, right? Somebody beat the champion, and the champion gives them a championship match. That's how it should be. But that's not how it was before then. Ziggler lost 4 straight times on television. He lost to Rusev, he lost to Randy Orton, and he lost to Seth Rollins. And not one of those guys is challenging him anytime soon for the Intercontinental title. And so I don't understand how you can possibly have a championship, put it on somebody, and just completely disregard it like that. Why even bother? Why even bother having him as the champion? Why bother having championships in the first place if they don't mean anything? So, and that was a bone of contention I had when I did the back and forth with Aubrey. I think that was one of the more spirited debates that we had. And again, if nothing else, I think that show proves that you can, in fact, disagree with somebody on the internet in a respectful way and not, you know, shout them down or call them names and insult them. You know, we have a difference of philosophy when it comes to the titles. Big time. A big time difference in philosophy. And, you know, I stand by my opinion on this. I think that they've done a very poor job of, you know, I don't want to use the word elevating, just making the U.S. and the Intercontinental titles mean what they should. They're not the top titles in the company, but in a way, they are kind of the de facto top titles temporarily, because Brock Lesnar's sitting on his ass at home. And you would think that of all times to make your Intercontinental Championship meaningful, to make it mean something and not turn it into a joke, now would be that time. And when it comes to house shows, I'm not saying you can necessarily headline with an Intercontinental title match. I think you could, not in the current state you couldn't. But you would think now's the time to actually elevate those belts and make them mean something, because we don't have a WWE championship, at least not for a couple more months, and they still don't do it, and it drives me nuts. So I think Ziggler goes over here just because he's lost so many times. I have to think the end game here is that he gets a big win on pay-per-view. Even if he does, it doesn't justify all the losing. You know, I still am a firm believer that if you're a champion, then you get beat, you become the champion. You don't get beat over and over and over and over again, you know, until you finally get to somebody where it's like, all right, now we're going to give this guy a championship match. I'm happy to see that, but I'm not happy about what happened before that. I mean, that's just, to me, that's just crazy that they would do that. But anyway, Ziggler's my pick here for this match. AJ Lee and Paige, I think, maybe will be the second match. Divas Championship on the line. There's been a lot of talk with Paige being added to the new season of Total Divas coming up in January. Well, you know, we have this supposed rule by Vince McMahon that anybody who appears on Total Divas cannot be the champion. Wouldn't shock me if he decided to change his mind on that like he does with everything else. But the fact is, Paige is not yet on Total Divas, so I put that on the side. I don't think that's going to have any impact on who wins this match. I still think AJ Lee wins. I think they've played hot potato with this thing so many times, back and forth, back and forth. There has to be some stability at some point. I can't just see them every time they're in the ring, the title changes hands. I think at some point, the champion has to retain. And I think now is that time. AJ wins, and she keeps the belt. Big Show and Rusev, I was very impressed. More so than I expected to be by their match a couple of weeks ago on Raw, whether it was a product of the hot crowd that night. And I'm not even sure if the crowd was that hot for the whole night, but for that match, the crowd was hot. And I think they were in Atlanta, right? They were doing the whole tomahawk chop. They were going crazy. And as a match, I thought that's how a Big Show Rusev match should be. And then Rusev, I think, busted out that drop kick out of nowhere that kind of blew everybody away. And again, I will keep saying this, that Rusev is in a lot of ways very underrated. I think people don't give him enough credit. They're bored by the gimmick. They're not into it. And so they paint with a broad brush and say, well, he's no good. That's not true. You know, I was watching the guy when he was on NXT, and even then I knew he's pretty good. He's not great. Maybe one day he will be, but he's not bad, especially looking at some of the other, you know, quote, bigger guys that have come through the system who, you know, let's be honest here, they probably have no business being in the ring. Rusev is not that guy. And Big Show can be good when he wants to be. So I think if they're motivated and if they got the crowd behind them, if the crowd buys into this whole story and everything we saw Monday night, which I'll talk about later in the Raw review, I think it has the potential to be a pretty good match. It won't steal the show, but they could go out there and have a good match. The only outcome here that makes sense is Rusev winning. They've built this up for so long. He's been undefeated now for so long. This is not a Bo Dallas undefeated streak that they just blow off on R-Truth on a random episode of Raw. This is going somewhere, and I think the end game with Rusev probably is John Cena. I don't know if they're going to a Rusev-Cena feud now, if they're going to wait until the beginning of the year, but I think at some point very soon, that's where we're headed, and Rusev has to stay undefeated. You know, whoever they pick to beat him, whether it's Cena or somebody new, it's got to be a big deal. Big Show knocking out Rusev and pinning him is not the way this match should end, and I don't think it will. I think Rusev gets the win. I think we're probably going to see the Mark Henry turn either tonight or very soon. Oh, probably tonight. I mean, I don't see why they wouldn't do it tonight. It just seems to be building to that, and that probably will be what caused Big Show the match. So Rusev is my pick. Gold and Stardust defending the tag team titles against the Usos. Look, these guys can go in the ring. They have great matches every single week. The problem is they're completely overexposed. How many combinations of six-man tags with the Usos and the Dust Brothers can we possibly see before we just get tired of it? It's the same matches over and over and over again. So I'm not really excited for the match. I think it'll be a very good match because these guys aren't capable of anything less than that when they're in there together. I'm just not as excited as I probably should be because we've seen it so many times. I think Gold and Stardust still have a lot of gas as tag team champions. It would be crazy to take the belts off them so soon, so they're my pick. Sheamus and The Miz. United States Championship match, I think, comes next. And I think Sheamus retains. There's no reason for him to drop the belt. As much as I think they've really dropped the ball on making these belts mean something, the thing about Sheamus is he's more protected than most guys in the mid-card would be, whether it's because of who he's friends with or whatever. Whatever it may be, Sheamus doesn't lose very often, but we've seen some fluke losses over the last few weeks. He got rolled up by Damian Mizdow. I don't think that after all those fluky losses, he's then going to get beat by The Miz on pay-per-view. I think he wins decisively here. But I do think that they're probably planting the seeds for an eventual breakup between Miz and Mizdow. They're doing a segment on the pre-show, the first ever Mizdow TV with Miz as his guest. Maybe that's where they plant some seeds of dissension between the two of them. But I don't think that either one of those guys is going to walk out with the championship. I think it's Sheamus. So he's my pick. John Cena and Randy Orton. Hell in a Cell. A lot of debate about what match is going to go on last tonight. It would be a slap in the face, I think, to Rollins and Ambrose for it not to be them, considering how many months this feud has been built up for. Randy Orton and John Cena, even though we've seen it a million times, has been built up for all of 1 week. And frankly, does not need to be inside Hell in a Cell, but it is. I think there's a lot more on the line for Rollins and Ambrose going out there if they're allowed to headline at the end of the show, which is a big deal. You know, Rollins did an interview this past week, and he was asked about that. And he could have easily said, oh, it's all internet hype. It's not a big deal. Either way, I'm going to go out there and we're going to steal the show. He said, no, it actually does. It means something to me. It means a lot to me because, you know, he wants to go out there and prove to people, as I'm sure Ambrose does, that those guys can hang. Those guys can be, you know, the final match on the card that sends people home happy and not dissatisfied, like, hey, we're the real main eventers. Like, no, we are the real main eventers. So I'm sure it really does mean something to those guys. I hope they get the chance. They deserve to go on last. Unless they have some kind of angle planned where Orton and or Cena are going to be involved in the other match, or vice versa, and that necessitates Cena and Orton going on last. Otherwise, I think Cena and Orton go on third from last. They put the other Divas matches, the buffer, probably between that and then and the main event, the real main event. I don't care if they have added a stipulation to this match. The stipulation is that the winner will get a WWE Championship match at a later date. They didn't say when, which is interesting, because that tells me that Brock Lesnar probably will not be back in a match, anyway, until the Royal Rumble, which I think is a mistake. I think if they do that, they missed an opportunity, I think, to get him in there with one or two other guys on his path to WrestleMania and maybe help elevate one or two other guys in the process, whoever it is, whether it's Cesaro or Sheamus or whoever it is. It doesn't look like they're doing it. That's too bad. That's disappointing. So the winner will get a championship match at some point down the road. They did not specifically say number one contenders match for whatever reason. When I did the interview with Aubrey, he seemed to think that there was a reason for that. He worked for the company for a couple of years, many years ago, and said that usually when those decisions are made, it means something, language means something, you know, words matter. We'll see. You know, we'll see what their plans are. As a match, I don't think they're going to have a bad match unless the crowd, for some reason, decides to crap all over them the way they did at the Royal Rumble in January. And, you know, I don't want to see the crowd crap on the match, but I do think that if people are sick and tired of seeing John Cena and Randy Orton, instead of just yakking about it, like me and everybody else, those people in the building tonight have the opportunity to do something about it. So if you're not into Cena Orton, just sit on your hands. Don't cheer for it if it bothers you that much. Turn your back on the match. Go take a piss break. Go grab something from the concession stands or the merchandise stand. Or if they do put this match on last, just leave. You've already seen Rollins and Ambrose and everything else you want to see. Just walk out. Early exit. Head home. That's how you send a message. If it bothers you that much, that's how you send a message. I don't see too many people doing that tonight, but that's what you can do. That's the only way you could send a message to these people. If it bothers you that much and you're tired of the same old, that's what you do. If you're in Dallas tonight, that's what you do. But I don't think these guys are going to have a bad match. I'm sure they'll probably have a good match, maybe a very good match. I don't have a dog in this fight, so to speak. I really am not favoring one guy tremendously so over the other one. I kind of have this feeling of apathy, like who gives a shit? If I had to pick a winner, I would like to see Randy Orton win just because Orton, Lesnar at least, is something different. And Randy Orton has some momentum right now. I don't know how long that's going to last. I don't know if he can sustain that popularity until January if they wait that long. But at least it's something different. And I know that we haven't seen the last chapter of Cena Lesnar. It was left unresolved with the finish at Night of Champions. I don't want to see John Cena and Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble. Do it at some point later on in the year if you want to, if Lesnar sticks around. But I don't have any interest in seeing that match at the Rumble. We've seen it enough. Right? We've seen enough. It's time to move on to somebody different. At least Orton is somebody different. But to say that I really gave a shit about who won this match, really, at the end of the day, cared, I don't. But I'm going to go with John Cena as my prediction on who I think will win. Even though I want Orton to win, I would prefer Orton to win. I think John Cena wins, and I think that sets up the rematch with Lesnar because they're stubborn and they have their plans, and I don't think they're going to deviate from those plans. Nikki Bella and Brie Bella, loser becomes the winner's bitch for the next 30 days. I guess now they've amended that. It's now the loser becomes the winner's personal assistant, whatever the hell that means. I'm going to go with Nikki Bella here. I mean, not that I care much about this feud, but I was very surprised to see Brie pin Nikki in that 6-diva tag match 2 weeks ago on Raw. Or maybe it was this past week. I don't even remember. I think Nikki got her win back, like a pin back on Brie on SmackDown last night. I didn't see the whole show yet, so maybe they're even Steven now. But I still feel like Nikki wins, and then we get a month's worth of skits where her sister Brie, against her will, because she doesn't want to get fired, has to do her sister's bidding. Whatever. I tried to coax out of Aubrey when I did the interview with him for the Sound Off Extra, because he is a huge fan of this Nikki versus Brie feud. And I said to him, I said, explain to me why. What is it about this feud that you like so much? And it was kind of a general answer. I don't really think he didn't go into too much detail about why. He just does. And that's fine. You know, people have different opinions. Not everybody likes the same things or hates the same things. I tried to look at it objectively after he said that and say, is there anything about this feud that I like? And there is. There's one thing about this feud that I like, and that's the end of it. And unfortunately, this will drag it out for at least another month, and that means we're not going to have the end of this feud for at least another 30 days, and that makes me very sad. But I think Nikki gets the win here. And then we have the real main event, in my opinion, whether there's a number one contender stipulation attached to it or not, I don't care. The real main event of this show is Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins inside Hell in a Cell. Maybe the first Hell in a Cell match in years. And I admit, off the top of my head, I don't remember the card from last year. Maybe there was a big-time match last year. Actually, no, it was Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan, which was not like a blood feud or anything like that. So you'd probably have to go back a few years to find a Hell in a Cell match on this show that really felt like it belonged inside Hell in a Cell. Like, it had been built up for months. It was some great rivalry that could only be settled inside the confines of this hell structure called Hell in a Cell. Ambrose and Rollins has cooled off a little bit over the last few weeks, I will say. I don't think it's their fault. I just think it's the fault of the writers and, you know, whatever. They've kind of taken the edge off of it for whatever reason. Ever since Ambrose came back from filming his movie, it hasn't been quite the same. And you know, he's been doing some comedy stuff, which has been hit or miss. This week, for example, I felt like was a miss. But it's still probably the top feud in WWE right now, like real, like, I hate your guts, I want to kill you kind of feud. Not two guys that have just been put together for the sake of having a match. This goes back to when Rollins turned on the Shield in June. And for whatever reason, it wasn't so much Reigns, it was more Ambrose who took offense to what Rollins did, and that was the real feud there. And they had the Lumberjack match at SummerSlam, which I thought was a dumb stipulation, but they made it work. To their credit, they made it work. It was probably the best Lumberjack match I've ever seen, because there haven't been that many really good Lumberjack matches, not saying much, but they made it work. They had an awesome match. Rollins won, right? He hit Ambrose in the face with the briefcase, got the pin. So you knew at some point these guys are going to have a rematch. They're going to have a blow-off. It's been months in the making. Hell in a Cell makes sense. Unfortunately, it's not Hell in a Cell from 10 years ago, which, you know, these guys could go out there and have a bloodbath, which would probably be a good way to cap off this feud. We're not going to see a bloodbath tonight unless somebody gets busted open hard way. But even still, I think these guys are good enough. They're going to go out there. They're going to have it on their mind that we have something to prove. You know, we've got to steal the show. Fuck Cena and fuck Orton. You know, we have to go out there and have the best match on this show. And if they have that mindset and they're motivated and they're given a good 15, 20, maybe 25 minutes, I mean, maybe they won't get that long, but if they've got a good amount of time, I don't know what they've got planned. I don't know if there's some big bump at the end that Rollins is going to take, but I think in the end, Ambrose goes over, because Ambrose is in need of that win a hell of a lot more than Rollins. Rollins losing as the heel, I can't even call him a chicken shit heel. I mean, he has run away from Ambrose before, but we've also seen a lot of instances where Rollins kind of goes head on. I wouldn't call him a chicken shit heel in the classic sense of what that is. But as a heel, he can lose, and it doesn't take anything away from him. Plus, he's got the briefcase. And it's not like Rollins is getting beat every single week like a lot of other guys that have held that briefcase before. Okay, I'm thinking of a guy like a Daniel Bryan. I'm thinking of a guy like a Dolph Ziggler or a Damian Sandow who won that briefcase and got beat week after week after week like jabronis. Rollins is not that. He's not a jabroni. He's not being beaten week after week. He's actually been kept pretty strong, I think. But he still has that as money in the bank. He can get beat, and it's not like it knocks him down, a couple of notches. He'll be fine. But Ambrose, on the other hand, who they're building up as maybe the top two babyface between behind John Cena, he needs this win a hell of a lot more. I mean, we saw Dean Ambrose on Monday night looking up at the lights, eating a pin by Randy Orton. I didn't agree with that finish. I didn't like the idea that Ambrose got pinned and he took the loss in that match. But we've seen Ambrose lose a few times on TV. And it's very easy for people to look at a guy and say, well, you know, he's kind of a loser. He loses a lot. So I like him, but I can't really get behind him that much. You've got to keep that guy strong. You know, that's what you have to do. I mean, it's been done before. You know, look back on history. Look back when they were building up Steve Austin as the next top babyface in the company. How many times did you see Austin losing on television? Not very often. How many times did you see Steve Austin doing bad comedy that falls dead in front of the crowd on television? Not very often. And I worry a little bit with Ambrose, and you know, we may as well get into Raw now in a second here. I'll talk more about the stuff with Ambrose from Monday night. The point is, he's got more to lose. He needs this win more. And I think it would be a great moment if they go off the air having this great match, and there's Ambrose maybe even standing on top of the cell the way that Rollins was at the end of Raw Monday night, standing up there, maybe holding a chair in the air victorious with everybody cheering him. I think that would be a great visual to go off the air for Hell in a Cell. So that's the pay-per-view. I think overall a strong card. Very curious, you know, who goes on last and how those two matches deliver, the Intercontinental title match and the Rollins-Ambrose match, because I do think that those matches have the potential to steal the show more than any other, and I'm looking forward to it. Now, Raw from Monday night was in Kansas City, Missouri. It was the go-home show. Sweet sound-off sign in the front row. Thank you, Austin. We were well represented in Kansas City this week, at least until security told everybody in the front row they were no longer allowed to hold up their signs, and so Austin couldn't hold it up anymore. But there was a good shot of it, I think, in the opening segment on Raw, so thank you to him for that. Keep bringing your sound-off signs to all these shows. I know we're going to have a couple of people at the show tonight with sound-off signs, so that's very cool. I thought overall Raw was a good show. Not a great show. It was a good show. I enjoyed Mick Foley's pop-in promo. I thought Dolph Ziggler and Cesaro had a good match. I thought the main event, tired as it may be, really picked up once they lowered the cell for those last few minutes. I also enjoyed Randy Orton losing his cool on that poor table outside the ring. Hulk Hogan also cut an amazing old-school Hulk Hogan promo after the show on the network, and then ended up posing in the ring with John Cena. Hogan will be on Raw this week. He actually posted a tweet that mentioned Rusev, so I'm not sure if that's a sign of what they have planned. There may be some kind of Rusev-Hogan face-off on Raw this week. That's a match that, had Hogan been in such a physical condition that he could still go, and I know there's people out there who are just completely appalled at the idea that Hulk Hogan would still be wrestling any matches, no matter what condition he's in. They just hate him. They can't stand him. They wish he would go away. He's Uncle Creepy, all this other stuff. But, you know, look, for what they're doing with Rusev, Hulk Hogan as this real American icon against Rusev is a match that would make sense. But, of course, Hogan can't go, so they're not doing a match. Anyway, a couple of other observations from Raw Monday night. They did what they could to build up Hell in a Cell. They did what they could to make the two main event matches feel like something special. I thought they did as good of a job as they probably could have done with 1 week build as far as Cena Orton are concerned. But this notion, and they did it throughout the night. Mick Foley, God bless him, he did it in his promo. And maybe he really believes this, or he's just a really good salesman. This idea that the Hell in a Cell is this demonic structure that changes lives, it just rings hollow after years of cell matches, half of which I honestly don't even remember taking place. That's how much they've diminished the impact of these matches. I was on WWE.com the other day, and they had photos. They have a gallery up with photos from every Hell in a Cell match ever. They had one on Raw in August of 1998 between Kane and Mankind. And I remember every single thing about that match. I remember Kane clobbering Foley with three sick chair shots to the head. I remember Steve Austin coming up from under the ring and attacking Kane. Undertaker outside trying to break into the cell. He's climbing it. He's trying to bust in there. This was on the highway to hell. They were building up the Austin Undertaker match for SummerSlam that year. That was a random cell match on Raw. Like, how many years ago was that? 15 years ago now? 16 years? And I still remember it. And then I see photos in the gallery I scroll through of Sheamus versus Randy Orton inside the cell. I don't remember that. John Cena versus CM Punk versus Del Rio versus Ziggler versus Jack Swagger. When the hell did that happen? I'm sure I must have watched it, but I'll be damned if I remember that match ever having taken place. So that's what happens when you do a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view every year and you have, you know, like this year, multiple cell matches on the show, not even just one, you have two. Hey, there was a time, I'm pretty sure, I can probably go back and find it in 2010 or 2011, I think they had three. There had to have at least been one Hell in a Cell pay-per-view where they had three cell matches on the same show. But my point is, that's what happens when you have that show every single year, every October, it's time for Hell in a Cell, and you have all these matches, and after a while, it's like, well, they don't mean anything anymore. Hell in a Cell used to mean something, and now it doesn't. So when I hear these guys go out there, and Mick Foley cut an awesome promo on Raw Monday night, he did a phenomenal job of making that match seem really, really special. But when I hear him and everybody else and Michael Cole talk about how this is a structure that changes lives, and it's, you know, this demonic thing, and that's a whole other issue, because we remember cell matches back in the day where guys were jumping off the top and they, you know, bleeding like a stuck pig, Undertaker with blood all over his face against Brock Lesnar. You know, that aspect is also missing now. So when I hear them talking about all this stuff, it's like, not really. It just kind of rings hollow to me. I thought the best promotion for this pay-per-view came in the form of that video package they aired on Monday night with all the footage from all of the Hell in a Cell wars from over the years. It was very similar to the video they do each year for the Royal Rumble. With the Royal Rumble stats, they were giving stats here on Hell in a Cell. I thought that video was fantastic, just very well done. I'd like for them to do more video pieces like that for these shows to make them feel special in the future. John Cena and Randy Orton had an in-ring segment. Orton came out first, then Cena, then Paul Heyman made an appearance. It ended with Cena going to give Heyman the attitude adjustment. I think he did. I think he laid... No, did he? No, he did. No, Cena put him down like a schmuck. Cena had him up for the attitude adjustment, put him back down, and then ate an RKO from Randy Orton and looked like a fool. And then Orton did what Cena should have done. He laid out the heel, Paul Heyman, and got cheered for it. So I was left thinking, okay, am I supposed to like Randy Orton? Am I supposed to cheer for Randy Orton? I have no idea. I thought they had 1 week to build this match up. It's a match that I don't give a shit about. And I've made it very clear before. I made the jokes about the voodoo dolls and all that kind of stuff. I do that because I, like many of you, I'm just tired. I'm tired of it in 2014. All the talent they have and all the new guys that have come and gone and that are going to be coming up from NXT. And I have no faith. You know, I think in 5 years, we're going to be sitting here watching another John Cena-Randy Orton match. And they built this match up as like almost like the blow-off to this storied rivalry. First of all, it is not a storied rivalry. John Cena versus Randy Orton, I don't care if they have 100 matches more, it will not be a storied rivalry. It's not about quantity. It's about quality. And the quality, I think, is what's missing here. Not that they haven't had good matches. They have. But it's not that feud you look back on like, wow, I remember that great feud that John Cena had with Edge. Or that great feud that John Cena had with CM Punk. I put those two way ahead of John Cena versus Randy Orton. Way ahead. So, again, a lot of the verbiage here, it felt hollow to me. I just couldn't buy into it. But I thought, as from a promo standpoint, Orton did fine. He's not really a great promo. Cena was fine. He was, you know, he wasn't too hokey or anything like that. And Heyman was Heyman. So I thought they did the best they could with it. It's not a match that should be happening, but they did the best they could to make it feel like something that we should care about. And it's obvious they put that stipulation there because they may well be ending the show with it. I just find it wrong that the consolation match on the show, which is what John Cena versus Randy Orton is, right? It was the consolation match. Randy Orton said, whoever loses the contract on a pole match with Cena and Ambrose, I want the loser. Now, he didn't use that word, but that's what he got. John Cena lost. Dean Ambrose won. And yet John Cena is wrestling for a title match. It just seems ass backwards to me. We had Rusev and Big E. These guys had a good match. They had a couple of matches, I think, a few months ago. They had a pay-per-view match, I remember. Just two big dudes beating the hell out of each other. Big E did that move where he just comes off the ropes and just steamrolls over his opponent. He did that with Rusev at one point. Looked very impressive. Not too many people will knock down Rusev like that, will mow him down the way the Big E did. And by the way, for the few people out there, and there aren't very many of them, but there were two people, one who emailed me and one who tweeted me a couple of weeks ago, who were still talking about this faction, right? And how I was, maybe they were listening to an old clip from a Sound Off episode like a month or two ago when I was still going off on how stupid they were to start whatever angle they had planned with Rusev, with Big E, rather, and Kofi and Xavier Woods, and how I was, at least I was intrigued. They had piqued my interest. Everyone's like, ah, new nation. And then nothing happened. And everyone was like, oh, Solomonster, they're at the house shows. They're on Main Event. Solomonster, they're in a battle royal on SmackDown wearing the same color tights. It's the end of October now, almost November. Can we all agree that they fucked up on these three guys? Okay, because apparently whatever gimmick it is, it's a house show /.com gimmick. I've seen some YouTube videos of them doing comedy, and that just completely killed it for me. I mean, the videos were fine, but what I was most intrigued by is that you have three guys who have been overlooked, and three guys who are very good. Kofi is very good, Big E is very good, and even Xavier. I never thought Xavier Woods was going to get above a certain level, but he's a very talented guy. You have three guys who are angry, they're pissed off at the system, and they want to do something about it. They want to grab it by the throat and strangle it. I was intrigued by that. Little did I know that, number one, the gimmick would never make television. Number two, the gimmick as it still stands is a comedy gimmick. It's comedy. It's their tried and true thing they love so much is comedy. Well, guess what? I don't give a fuck. I don't care. But for the people who may still be left who are asking me about this and whatever, it's almost November. I think we can all agree they fucked up. They dropped the ball. There is no gimmick. There is no faction. There will never be a gimmick or faction. They had an idea. They dropped it like they do everything else. There was promise. They squashed it for whatever reason. And it's too bad. It really is too bad because Kofi is doing nothing. Big E will pop up on Raw every now and then and do the job for somebody. And those guys are better than that. I'm not saying put the title on them, but I'm saying they should be doing more, and they're not. And they had the chance, and they blew it, and that's a shame. And that's one of the things I'll look back on when 2014 is over and say, man, that was one thing that had potential, and they really fucked up on that. And that's too bad. But Rusev got the win here. They did the angle after the match with the soldier who... Well, let me give some backstory here. So what happened is Rusev wins, and he's waiting for the Russian flag to come down, and the flag isn't coming down. And then we see Big Show on the Titantron, and lo and behold, the American flag comes down, and they play Lex Luger's anthem from back in the day, and everyone's cheering, and Big Show is happy and smiling. So Rusev teases that he's going to do what Big Show did, which is yank the flag down. And this appalls everybody. Why it appalls everybody, I have no idea. Apparently, it's okay for Big Show to yank down the Russian flag. Not okay for Rusev to do the same thing to the American flag. Sounds a little hypocritical to me, but nonetheless, he was about to do this dastardly deed. And all of a sudden, this was too much for a soldier in the front row to just tolerate. So he hopped the guardrail, and he tries to run into the ring to stop Rusev from desecrating the flag. And this guy gets into the ring, and then he's grabbed by a security guard, and Rusev delivers a kick, a flying kick to the guy's face, knocks him down. This abhorrent action by Rusev, attacking a U.S. soldier, a serviceman to our country. And some people were offended by this. And I knew, look, there's always going to be people who allow themselves to be offended by shit like this. Some people were offended. Of course, there was nothing offensive about it at all. Nothing. There was not a single thing about this angle as it was done that was offensive. If this offended you, you would have hated the 1980s. That's all I could say. Other people hated the angle because the guy didn't have the proper, you know, patches or medals on his uniform. Who cares? Seriously, who cares? These people can't keep their own storyline straight from week to week. You expect them to pay that much attention to detail? That's what bothered you about this angle? The angle was goofy, but I didn't have a problem with it. You know, they're trying to put more heat on Rusev, and we'll see what kind of reaction they get tonight at the pay-per-view as far as how effective that angle really was. Big Show came out in the very next segment, and I would say he delivered a good promo. He didn't say much, but it wasn't really even so much about what he said. It was about his demeanor. He was clearly visibly upset by what had just happened. It was a goofy angle, so this came off a little corny, but I thought he did a good job with it. When Big Show is really angry and intense, and we saw some of this a year ago, if you remember, when Big Show was getting that big push against the Authority, and we all thought it was leading to him and Triple H in a match, and they never did it. He did knock out Triple H with a punch on Raw once. They did, I think they did Randy Orton and Big Show instead. What a great frickin' idea that was. But when Big Show is on, and he's given something to work with here, and he's out there, and he's trying to give the impression that he is just very appalled by what he had just seen, and he is going to take this guy at the pay-per-view, and he is going to tear him limb from limb, I bought into it. I bought into angry Big Show. Like I said earlier, when Big Show is good, when he's on his A-game, he can be good. I don't care how big he is or how old he is, the big slow. Remember The Rock used to make fun of him, the big slow? You know, that whole thing. I miss Rock and Big Show, by the way, as a feud. I liked it. But anyway, he can be good. I'm looking forward to the match to see if they can live up to the enjoyment level I had for their first match. But the whole soldier angle, get over it, people. It was hokey, yes, but there was nothing wrong with it beyond that. So we had already seen Sheamus and AJ lose their respective matches on this show. I was just waiting for the trifecta. And they did not disappoint. Dolph Ziggler lost to Cesaro, giving Dolph his fourth consecutive television loss before he finally won on SmackDown this week. I started the hashtag ChampsAreChumps. I want to get that trending. ChampsAreChumps, because on this show, that's exactly what they are. I will say that that uppercut that Cesaro beat Ziggler with in the end, wow, that was a hell of an uppercut. And I said a long time ago, he should be using that as his finish, not the neutralizer. Ditch the neutralizer, use that as a setup move. That uppercut is an awesome finish because, look, people pop big for moves that you hit out of nowhere. Or if you propel somebody into the air and catch them on the way down. That's one of the reasons why the RKO was so over. That's one of the reasons why Diamond Dallas Page was so popular, because of the Diamond Cutter. Or Stone Cold with the Stunner. It's a move that, you know, you can hit out of nowhere. And Cesaro's a strong enough guy where he can't just hit you with the uppercut. Again, he can catch you coming off the top. He can literally grab you and throw you into the air and on the way down, catch you with an uppercut. And it gets a reaction every single time. It's a move that can be hit out of nowhere, that has an impact, that gets a big pop. I don't understand why he never used it, or if it was their decision for him not to use it, who knows? But I hope it's not the last time we see that. Maybe it was a one-time thing, and the neutralizer is still his finish. I'm sure he'll bust it out tonight for one of the falls in his match with Dolph, but I would like to see more of that going forward, him using that move as a finish. We had the Dean Ambrose segment. He came out with a bag of some kind, and in the bag was a mannequin. It was a doll, I guess maybe is a more appropriate term for it. And the doll was dressed up as Seth Rollins, and he sat the doll down in the middle of the ring, and it brought back horrible memories for me, because the last time I remember seeing the visual of somebody sitting in the ring with a doll was Triple H with the Katie Vick doll. And that brought back horrific memories for me. So not the kind of memories you want to be dredging up. But there he was, Dean Ambrose. Now, let me just say, because when I made this comment on the show that I did the Sound Off Extra interview with Aubrey, I made the comment that we were both in agreement. That was awful. This doll portion of the segment was horrendous. And I stand by that. But that does not mean that I hate all comedy with Dean Ambrose. I hate when people paint with a broad brush like that. I made that comment and people were like, you're out of your mind. I love the comedy that he's doing with the ketchup and the mustard. I didn't say anything about the ketchup and the mustard, people, okay? I made one comment about one segment that sucked. Just admit, it sucked. It was no good. And the people in the building felt the same way, because I've seen Dean Ambrose do comedy in backstage segments, in front of the crowd in recent weeks, throwing out t-shirts, and people were reacting to it, or they were laughing at it. I thought the line on the Stooges a few weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was, where he said, oh, they set the cruiserweight division out after me, I thought that was brilliant. So I'm, by and large, a fan of Dean Ambrose's comedy and his sense of humor, and and some of the stuff that they've scripted for him up until this segment. This segment was a killer, and I say, you know, the thing that concerns me about it, it's one segment, 2 weeks from now, we won't remember it, hopefully. But if this is a pattern of the kind of stuff, of the kind of material they're going to give this guy going forward, I hope he's, you know, I hope he stands up for himself and says, no, no, this won't work, this is no good, or at least let me put my spin on it. I really hope this wasn't an idea that he had input into. Maybe it looked good on paper. It certainly did not work out well in execution. It just was lame, and Dean Ambrose did not come off as somebody cool. And that was an element to him that he still has, but up to this point, he's been kind of that cool, odd, quirky guy, but there's a certain cool factor, I guess, to the character, and that's important if you're trying to get him over as a babyface that people can get behind. That's what worked so well for Steve Austin back in the day. And I've heard more than one person recently tell me that, you know, there's a lot of Dean Ambrose that reminds them of Steve Austin. There's a lot of Dean Ambrose that reminds me of Roddy Piper and Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman especially. Those are not bad people to be compared to. But I would never see, I don't think, Steve Austin when he was on The Ascent agreeing to do a bullshit segment like this. You know, back then he was driving around a cement truck and a Zamboni and... You know, maybe the closest thing that he did that was kind of lame, and I actually thought it was kind of lame even when they did it, was when he had the Bang Bang gun and Vince pissed his pants. And even that wasn't bad, but that might have been the closest thing to something uncool that Austin ever did. You just never had that problem with him. And I don't care if it's the Attitude Era or if this era was rated TVY7 or TVG. You know, you can still have Dean Ambrose doing a lot of that stuff. He doesn't have to be swearing and drinking beer, but I'm hoping that it was just a miss. Not that I was a huge fan of him shooting ketchup and mustard out of a holster, although I didn't mind the hot dog cart. I mean, I was in the building that night, and that looked pretty cool. It was a cool visual, but this doll thing was a killer. I mean, this was just not good. It was not funny. It seemed like it was dragging a little bit until Rollins finally came out. And he cut a promo. And then even Rollins' promo felt like it was dragging. And then we heard the car crash, and out came Mick Foley, and everybody cheered. And it was really cool to see him. We don't see him very often on the show. You know, he's a very vocal guy. I like Mick Foley because he's clearly a fan. You know, he watches the show every single week. Whenever he's on the road doing his comedy act, or he's in Santa Claus school, all the different things that he does, he'll tweet out, hey, you know, I didn't get back to my hotel room in time, I missed half of Raw, what happened? Like, he's really into it. You know, a lot of guys, Chris Jericho's talked about this, you know, he doesn't pay attention to what's going on when he's not around, or he's on the road with Fozzy, he doesn't watch the show every single week. And that's his prerogative, you know, that's fine. I'm sure Brock Lesnar, he's the WWE champion, he's probably not watching the show either. But Foley is clearly still a fan, and he's into it, but that could be, you know, he could be his own worst enemy sometimes. He'll make comments that I'm sure rub people in that company the wrong way. I was kind of surprised, to be honest, that they called him, but they, you know, figured, hey, Foley is most associated more than anybody else with Hell in a Cell. We need one last big sell job on this show. Who better to go to than Mick Foley, who can cut a promo better than most? And I thought he knocked it out of the park. He did great. Again, the stuff about how the cell will change lives. It changed his life, that's for sure. But it rings hollow when it comes to matches these days. I like the part where he talked about how his career is kind of divided up into two parts, pre-cell and post-cell. I look at Shawn Michaels the same way, kind of pre-back injury, post-back injury. So there's a lot of truth to that. So when Foley showed up, it rescued the segment. I thought that had it not been for him, this would have been a complete killer of a segment. It wouldn't have done a whole lot to bolster the argument that these two guys should be headlining the show, even though they should. It would have been a weak kind of go-home angle before the pay-per-view, but Foley saved it. And so this ended up being a pretty good segment when it was over. Cena and Ambrose in the main event. Really quick, talk about that. It was a 3-on-2 handicap match, street fight against Randy Orton, Seth Rollins, and Kane. Not a fan of Ambrose and Rollins touching and basically wrestling a match here before the pay-per-view. And Ambrose not being all that interested in just tearing a hole in this guy. It was almost like at one point, they're just wrestling. They're just wrestling a match. And for two guys that have had this blood feud built up for so long, you would think that Ambrose, as soon as he gets his hands on Rollins, would just start ripping hair out of his roots and, you know, what was it that he said? I'm going to move your ear to where your nose is and all that kind of stuff. And no, it was just a wrestling match. So I didn't like that aspect. I was not a fan of Ambrose taking the losing fall here. I guess John Cena couldn't. No, you know what, though? That's bullshit. John Cena could have taken the fall in this match. You know, I think a guy like John Cena taking the losing fall in a fucking handicap match 6 days before the pay-per-view, nobody's going to remember it. It's not going to hurt him at all. A guy like Dean Ambrose, the visual of him losing matches right now, and he's lost, this is not the first time he's been pinned, it does more to hurt him. I just think they should be doing everything in their power to protect this guy right now. You've got Daniel Bryan, who the hell knows when or even if he'll be back. Roman Reigns is gone for a little while longer. You're trying to make this guy as comparable as possible to a guy like John Cena on his level. That means you've got to push him like you would push Super Cena. And that doesn't necessarily mean shove him down everybody's throats every single week. But that means you've got to protect him the way you wouldn't protect most other guys on the roster. And I feel like they're not quite doing that. But Ambrose is so damn good that he's probably going to get over anyway. I hope that happens. Because I like the guy a lot. The thing that really annoyed me about this match, and I know it annoyed a lot of you too, because you were tweeting me like crazy. Tags in a street fight. What? And somebody pointed out, I think it was Halen in our Facebook group, he pointed out the fact that, well, you know, when the Shield and Evolution had their six-man tag, I guess it would have been a payback. There were tags in that match, too. I honestly don't remember that. I remember the match. I don't remember there being tags. And if there was, I guess it didn't bother me that much. But I don't know why it bothered me here. They built this up as a street. They kept burning that into our brain. Street fight, street fight, street fight. And I got to watch these. And Cena's on the apron, and Ambrose is getting the shit kicked out of him. And all Cena can do is just stand there. Come on, tag me. I'm like, hey, motherfucker, get in the ring and help your partner. What are you standing on the apron like an asshole for? It annoyed me. And he's got to hold on to that tag team rope. I feel like when John Cena popped out of his mother's womb, he had that tag rope wrapped around his hand. Like, he doesn't let go of that sucker. It's bad enough most street fights these days in WWE are very lame. They're not real street fights. Street fights are come as you are, bring what you want, or bring what you will. I think that's how they used to build them. So you show up and you're wearing jeans or, like, okay, Chris Jericho and CM Punk. That's a street fight. That might have been the last real street fight in WWE that I remember seeing when they had that street fight at Extreme Rules in 2012. It was the same show that we had the first Lesnar-Cena match when Lesnar came back. Okay? Because I think Punk was wearing jeans and Jericho, or maybe Jericho was, but that was a street fight. That's how a street fight should be. It's bad enough we don't even have that, and most street fights these days are lame. Now I gotta watch these guys on the apron waiting for the tag. Give me a fucking break. So the Cell eventually got lower. They had the Hell in a Cell structure there. You knew it would come into play, and it gets lowered for the last like 4 or 5 minutes of the match. And just the visual of these guys going at it and the cells all around them, it was cool. I mean, they used to do that back in the day a lot when they were hyping up a Hell in a Cell match back in the days of Austin, Undertaker, Foley, and Rock. The cell would be, somebody would lower the cell, and then the show would go off the air with like Austin kicking all their asses on top of the cage. So I thought that made for a great visual, and I liked that aspect of it. Not a fan of Orton pinning Ambrose, as I said. But then we see Seth Rollins delivering a curb stomp to Randy Orton and leaving Orton laying. And Seth Rollins is the last man standing as the show goes off the air. He's standing triumphant on top of the cage. So this was not a bad show. Look, people, we've seen some bad shows if you go back over the last 4 or 5 weeks. This would be very low on the list in terms of, quote, bad shows. I would put this in the good category. There was a lot that annoyed me, but I take what I can get. That's how bad things have gotten. You just got to take what you can get. And when there's a show that maybe isn't that great, but it's acceptable, like there was nothing on there that really offended you, you had one or two good matches, the angles mostly made sense, that's all you could really ask for. I don't expect much from these people these days. So this was a good show. NXT this week was a pretty basic show, not the strongest show they've put on over the last few weeks. The Ascension opened with a victory over Jason Jordan and Ty Dillinger. Dillinger tagged in, got dropped immediately, and pinned after the Fall of Man. Hideo Itami ran down all by himself when the match was over like an idiot and got beaten down 2-on-1 by the Ascension, and then he was left for dead with the Fall of Man. And I watched this, and, you know, all I could think to myself, almost as like a calming device to keep myself calm, is just two more weeks. I keep saying that to myself over and over again. We got a graphic for Tyler Breeze being in action later on in the show, and the announcer, Rich Brennan, who did the voiceover, big production fuck-up here, because he made a comment about how Tyler Breeze had just lost a number one contenders match to Sami Zayn last week. So how will he recover from that loss? And all I could think is, there was no match with Sami Zayn last week. What the hell is this guy talking about? So I hope they didn't just spoil a match that's coming up here on NXT in the next few weeks. They probably did. It's not the first time we've seen a production fuck-up like this. I mean, I've been told by people before that the production people in charge, or at least some of them, are students from Full Sail University who are, you know, practicing to one day be in television production themselves. So you expect some mess-ups like that. Like, there was one week where they were promising, I think, like a no-disqualification championship match, and in fact there was no-disqualification championship match. So hopefully they didn't spoil a future match here by saying that. Tyler Breeze was in action, though. He pinned CJ Parker with the beauty shot. I've gotten a few emails this week from people who asked me stuff about NXT, and they brought up Tyler Breeze and how maybe it was their first time seeing him, and how he's only got like a couple of moves, and they don't see what the big deal is about the guy. All I can say is that if you've never seen the guy's work before, I guess it would make sense that you would feel that way. But if you've seen him over a period of time, if you've seen a bunch of Tyler Breeze matches, he's got more than two moves. I don't really know where that criticism is coming from. I mean, even in this match, it wasn't a long match. It was pretty basic, but he busted out a nice standing Hearn Karana at one point on CJ Parker and into a flurry of punches. Very Shawn Michaels-esque, I thought, the way he pulled that off. I'm still a big Tyler Breeze fan. I'm a big fan of Breeze now as much as I was before. I just think, again, he's one of those guys who we probably haven't seen fully what he's capable of. But I would tell you to go back and watch the match he had with Kalisto, which was a few months ago. I have no idea what episode it was. I'm sure if you type it into the Google machine, it will tell you when Tyler Breeze and Kalisto had their match on NXT. And even a match the match that he had with Sami Zayn, which was either on the last... not the last special, the one before that. Or watch him in that four-way on the last NXT special. I don't know how you can watch those matches and tell me that, hey, what's so special about this guy? He's only got two moves. Like, he's not John Cena. Okay, I don't know what that criticism is, or I don't know where it's coming from. Maybe you need some Visine in your eyes, perhaps, but I disagree. I'm a big believer in Breeze. How far he'll go once he makes the main roster, I have no idea. I'm a little worried about the guy, quite frankly. The gimmick itself doesn't lend itself necessarily to being in the main event, but I think he's the kind of guy who's... You know, we saw that with Shawn Michaels when he first branched out as a single star, right? He was the cocky, arrogant guy. He used to bring a mirror to the ring with him, and he would look at his reflection in the mirror, kind of like what Lex Luger did when he was the narcissist. It's all about evolution, right? Those characters evolved. I mean, Lex Luger became a completely different character for... completely different reasons. But Shawn Michaels, over time, he evolved. He evolved into a perfectly acceptable, believable, cocky, arrogant jerk heel, and eventually a main event level babyface. And I'm not saying Tyler Breeze in the ring is the same caliber performer that Shawn Michaels is, although his look and his moves and his mannerisms very much so remind me of an early heel Shawn Michaels from back in 1992, 1993. Absolutely. And I think he could go far as long as that character continues to evolve. If he's still doing the same exact character 2 years from now, then yeah, he's not going to go anywhere. It's all a matter of, is the guy going to be given a chance? When is he going to be called up? And how, if at all, will that character evolve? Is the evolution just people keep cheering him and so he becomes a babyface? Because I think if that happens, he's dead. I think a heel Tyler Breeze is much better than a babyface Tyler Breeze, because a babyface Tyler Breeze ain't going to last very long. It's like kind of like Randy Orton. Babyface Randy Orton is good in small doses. You turn Randy Orton full-on babyface, give it a few months, he's going to be dead in the water. He's just going to be just another guy, you know, and it's just, it's not what lends itself to Randy Orton being a babyface. I think he was a natural heel. A lot of guys say that. I was born to be a heel. I don't ever want to be a babyface. Well, we need some baby faces. At some point, everybody turns, but it's just a matter of how it's handled. But, you know, we'll see where Breeze ends up in the future. Mojo Rawley came down during the match. He was just staring a hole through Tyler Breeze, who injured his shoulder a couple weeks ago. And then Breeze, it was funny, when Breeze won and he spotted Mojo, as Breeze is kind of backing up down the aisle and looking at Mojo, he's mocking his shoulder injury. He was such a great heel here. This was after we saw Mojo in some kind of shoulder apparatus the week before, sitting backstage talking about how he was going to take time off to heal up and have surgery. And here he was back on the show this week. I remember I made the comment last week. I said, take your time, Mojo, take your time. And this motherfucker shows up 1 week later. Go away! I think for a guy like him, honestly, absence makes the heart grow fonder. He goes away, heals up, comes back with a different attitude, whether he's a heel or a face or whatever. That could do wonders for Mojo Rawley, because right now the guy is just, he's not cutting it. He's not cutting it. He's a one-trick pony, and the best thing for him would be to go away for a while, as in months, not weeks, and then come back fresh. They aired a Baron Corbin vignette. That vignette, when it was over, I watched it. They aired it the week before, but I watched it. It reminds me of, I don't know why, it just gives me an American Badass Undertaker vibe, and I don't think it's the bike or the tats. I mean, that's part of it, him hopping on a motorcycle and having all the tattoos that he does, plus he's a big guy, he's not 6'10 and a half like Taker was, but he's got to be every bit of 6'5", 6'6", maybe 6'7" even. He's a big guy, he's a big dude. And I think there's big things in his future. I mean, we haven't seen a lot from him in the ring, and that's going to tell the tale. If he can go out there and have a 30-second squash, that's great. But what happens when he's in there with somebody who, you know, isn't a Shawn Michaels or a Bret Hart, and he has to have a 10-minute match or an 8-minute match, which I'm sure he will. I mean, maybe even on the next NXT special. Maybe they'll give him a match, and they expect him to go out there for more than just a minute and have a decent match. That's when I think we're going to know how far this guy may be able to go. But he's got the look. Somebody asked me, what is it about Baron Corbin that you like so much? He's very bland. He's got presence. I don't want to say, oh, he's got the it factor, whatever the fuck that is. He's got a presence about him. Now we just have to find out if he can back it up in the ring. But so far, so good. The Vaudevillains beat Wesley Blake and Buddy Murphy. The Vaudevillains now use a European uppercut to the back of the head into a neckbreaker combo as their finish, which is kind of cool, I guess. But I said this on Twitter. I'm sorry. The Vaudevillains, as an act, they bored me to tears. They just bore me to tears. And I used to be a big fan of Aiden English. I don't hate the guy now, although I think even if Aiden English was still doing the singles thing and not doing a tag team thing with this other guy, with Simon Gotch, I probably would be over Aiden English by now as well. Unlike a Tyler Breeze, who I still dig the gimmick and I'm still into the guy, I don't feel the same way about these guys. Maybe it's the gimmick itself is very old-timey, and so that rubs off on me in my opinion. You know, they're not bad in the ring. I mean, they're a good team. It's just the act, it bores me to tears. And I know where these guys are headed, and so it's just something I guess I'm going to have to tolerate until that next special. Sasha Banks and Bayley had a match. Very good match. Not surprising. The NXT women usually have a good match. Sasha beat her with the Bank Statement submission, which, again, I think is a kick-ass name for her finish. And she was beating up Bayley post-match. Becky Lynch came down to make the save, and then, predictably, Becky Lynch turned on poor Bayley. The second time that Bayley has let her guard down and allowed herself to be turned on, to be attacked by somebody who she thought was her friend. Poor Bayley. And so she formed an alliance. Seemingly Becky Lynch has formed an alliance with Sasha Banks. I like the storytelling here because this is exactly the same thing that happened with Sasha Banks when she first turned heel, if you remember. It was a segment with Summer Rae. I want to say it was Summer Rae backstage that led to this change in attitude for Sasha Banks, who had been this, you know, baby face, very, almost kind of shy, nice girl next door type. And then Summer said to her whatever it was that she said, and Sasha had this change in attitude, and it was almost like the switch got flipped, and she became the boss. She became this bitch character that she has enhanced over time. I mean, I think Sasha is one of the best women they have, probably right behind Charlotte, even more so maybe than Bayley. And I love Bayley. I mean, they got a lot of good women down there right now, a lot of good talent on the way. But I like the storytelling because it's the exact same thing that happened with Sasha. And here we are now. I don't know how long it's been. If it was a year, year and a half ago that that stuff went down with Summer and Sasha. But it led to the formation of the BFFs. But here we are. Sasha's all grown up. She's the boss, playing the role now of Summer Rae to Becky Lynch's Sasha Banks. We had a backstage segment, a quickie, with Enzo Amore, Colin Cassidy, and Carmella. Enzo at one point called himself 4G because he's well-connected. He got Carmella a match with Emma next week. So it'll be good to see Emma back since they're not doing fuck-all with her on the main shows. Can we keep Emma? Can we have some kind of, like, talent exchange deal going on here? Can I like, get the red telephone line to Vince McMahon's office and call him up and just be like, can we please have Emma? Like, we'll pay you for her. She's not doing anything. The poor woman is just being wasted. Adrian Neville and Titus O'Neil in the main event, NXT Championship match. So, here's what happened. Titus kicked his ass for 95% of the match until Adrian Neville caught him coming into the corner with knees to the face, and then he landed the red arrow and got the pin. That's it. That is all that happened in this match. He just got his ass kicked the entire time, and then he won out of nowhere. I was not a fan of that. Titus showed off some impressive strength. He was ragdolling Adrian Neville around in there, which looked kind of cool. He had him in a bear hug for what felt like 38 minutes in the middle of the match. But other than that, Neville didn't do anything. Neville is the NXT champion. He will probably be called up to the main roster in a matter of months. Let's put it this way. He's closer to his call-up now than he was 6 months ago, which I guess he would have to be. So anyway, that's actually a really stupid statement to make. That's like saying that next week I will be closer to death than I am today. No shit. Yeah, so that was a dumb comment by me. But anyway, I'm entitled to a dumb comment every now and then. One per show. Sami Zayn came out on stage after the match to congratulate Neville on retaining his NXT championship and saying that he is on a mission to take it away from him. And Adrian Neville agreed to give him a shot anytime he wanted to. And then he said, Sammy, you can't win the big one. And then they immediately went off the air. It was actually a cool way to end the show. Obviously, they're building to the match between the two of them in December at the next NXT special. And I'm looking forward to that day, very much so. I know there were some spoilers that leaked about the full card for the next TakeOver special in December. I did see them. I'm not going to talk about it here. We will see it unfold in the weeks to come. But I will say that this next special coming up, I am looking forward to that every bit as much, if not more so, than the previous NXT specials we have gotten this year. These specials have been a revelation. And if nothing else, if you're not into classic content and you're sick of the current product and don't give two shits about the pay-per-views, if nothing else, I think that network is worth the $9.99 for NXT alone, and especially those NXT specials. So if you haven't seen them, you are missing out big time. Do not miss the one coming up in December. That's all I'll say. One last NXT note here, and it's a big one, and that is The Undertaker was spotted at the NXT TV tapings this past week backstage. He's also been spotted at the Performance Center in recent weeks, and apparently he has told people that his new role, or a new role for him within WWE, is that he is going to be working with the developmental talent going forward as what is being deemed an advisor. So he is not a coach. He's not going to be moving to Orlando and getting in the ring with these guys like the other trainers like Billy Gunn and Bill DeMott and all of them. But I think that's incredible. I think it's an incredible opportunity for the guys at NXT because you've got a guy like The Undertaker, who I'm sure all those guys look up to. He's this revered figure. He's been doing this for so long. And to have him available to you just to critique your matches or give you advice and pointers on what to do and what not to do, I think is really cool. And quite frankly, just the idea, the visual in my mind of The Undertaker at the Performance Center giving advice and pointers to Kevin Steen or Kenta, it just blows my mind. So, Undertaker doing that, I think, is really cool. I don't think it's necessarily confirmation of him being done, although every time some news or photo leaks of The Undertaker, And I just see him out there with his wife. I mean, look, Michelle McCool is constantly posting photos of her and The Undertaker on Instagram. So when these photos leak, like if you just want to see The Undertaker in a natural, normal environment, just go to Michelle McCool's Instagram page. There's a whole bunch of photos up there. The guy's living life, right? Remember those old Michelle McCool segments on SmackDown? I love life. She's loving life. Well, that's what Undertaker's doing, man. I mean, I don't know how much he's hurting these days, but he's out with his wife. He's living his life. He's going to football games. Now he's going to help train some of the younger talent. If I didn't know any better, I would think this guy is done. And if he's done, what a career he's had. Put him in the Hall of Fame next year. Let him work with the younger talent and live out the rest of his days doing whatever the hell it is he wants to do. That's what I say. Look, I'm sure his body is so banged up, and there's been rumors that he's had certain surgeries. He may have had his hip replaced. I think Scott Hall kind of let the cat out of the bag on that when he had made a comment in an interview that the doctor he went to for his hip replacement had done some kind of procedure on The Undertaker's hip where they were like shaving it. I forgot what he said, but there's no doubt in my mind that when that guy is done, which he may already be, he's going to have a whole bunch of things replaced. He's going to have another hip replacement on the other hip, maybe a knee replacement, a shoulder replacement. I mean, the guy is falling apart. And, you know, if he's done, then good. Let him have whatever work done he needs to have done so he feels, you know, normal again and can live life the way he wants to live it. I mean, The Undertaker is a guy who's earned that. And if his last match is a loss at WrestleMania to Brock Lesnar, yeah, it would have been cool for him to go out on a high note and ride off like a cowboy into the sunset, right, and have all the smoke billowing up, and when the smoke clears, he's gone. That would be a cool way for him to kind of cap off his career. But, you know, him going out with a loss, you know, the streak ended, and when the streak was over, that was it. Would have been nice if they had built that up previously by him saying that when that day comes that I lose, I'm done. He never did say that. But yeah, the more I hear about The Undertaker, that's the impression I get, is that he may really be done. There may be no match at WrestleMania next year. ProWrestlingTees.com is the new home for Sound Off shirts and apparel. Get your official Solomonster Sounds Off logo t-shirt and other assorted designs like the new Eat Sleep Sound Off Repeat shirt, which sounds an awful lot like a typical week for me. And I know it is for some of you guys as well. Now you can show your support for the podcast wherever you go by buying a shirt. Hell, buy two of them. Pro Wrestling Tees accepts PayPal as payment and ships internationally, all over the world. The more shirts we sell, the more designs we'll be able to offer in the future, but we can only do that with your help. Be one of the first 25 people to buy a shirt, and you'll get a shout-out right here on the Sound Off. Visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff to go directly to our new store. That's ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Still nothing new on a TV deal for TNA. T-minus 4 weeks until the last new episode of Impact before their self-imposed off-season. It may be an extended off-season if they don't announce a new TV deal soon. This week's show is all about the 8-team tag team tournament to determine who faces the Wolves for the tag team titles. Each participant got to choose their own tag team partner. Matt Hardy came out to open the show, and he picked Jeff Hardy as his tag team partner. Thank God it wasn't Willow. That's all I have to say. DJ Zima was their opponent. He picked Jesse Godders as his partner. Hardy's won with a swanton on Jesse. Basic match. Bram was out next. He called himself the new King of Hardcore. Great. More of the hardcore shit. Devon came out. Didn't look too happy about Bram attacking him last week for no reason. Two guys went at it. They went at it long enough where I thought, you know, at some point they're just going to send a ref out and make it official. But instead, after 5 minutes of brawling, they broke these two guys up. Kurt Angle comes out and says, I'm going to put you in a hardcore match later in the show. Backstage, Brittany found Sam Shaw, wanted to know if he was going to do what she had asked him to do. And Shaw said he wasn't so sure. And Brittany said that she would really like it if he did what she wanted him to do. And to me, it felt like a reenactment of a scene that has probably played out a million times behind the scenes with women and promoters in real life, if you catch my drift. Low-key picked Samoa Joe as his tag team partner in the tag team tournament, faced off with Sam Shaw, who picked Gunner as his partner. And then Gunner, the good soldier that he is, cut a promo about never leaving a man behind. Very similar to Pat Patterson's old catchphrase, never leave a man's behind. Brittany came out during the match, kept trying to get Shaw to do whatever it is that she wanted him to do. Probably go for a tryout at the Performance Center. She sees the writing on the wall. Anywho, Brittany grabbed Gunnar's boot as he tried to come off the ropes, and the distraction was enough to allow Loki to catch him with a wicked kick to the face, like a springboard kick to the face. He stumbles backwards right into the choke by Joe. He's forced to tap, so Joe and Loki get the win. They move on. After the match, Gunnar confronted Brittany in the ring, told her, "Leave Samuel alone," which gave Shaw just enough time to reappear with a steel chair. He attacked Gunnar with it numerous times, over and over. So I guess he's crazy again, or he was never not crazy, because the dude was in a fucking padded cell when Gunnar decided to drop by, play Go Fish with him, and then bail him out. The dumb shit gets what he deserves. The moral of the story is this. Most crazy people are in the nut house for a reason. Playing cards with them will not cure them of their ills. Rebel, scheduled to wrestle Angelina Love, got Havoc instead. Hardly seems like a fair trade-off. Rebel took a choke slam before Gail Kim came back. Shoulder was all taped up. And she was there to extract revenge on the monster who injured her and took her title. They brawled into the aisleway. They were still fighting when they cut away. Bram and Devon, hardcore match. So if you want to know what happened here, I want you people to close your eyes. Okay, close your eyes right now. And picture trash cans and trash can lids everywhere. Got it? You see him? Okay, now open your eyes. Congratulations, you just saw Bram and Devon. That was the entire match. Magnus ran down at the end. He hit Devon with the kendo stick, which allowed Bram to grab his giant wrench and hit Devon with it for the pin. MVP and Kenny King against Mr. Anderson and Sergeant Chris Melendez in a tag team tournament match. Melendez looked good here. He looked better than he did the last time I saw him. He delivered a fisherman suplex to Kenny King at one point. King later rolled up Melendez with a cradle for the pin. Not much else to it. Eric Young recruited Rockstar Spud as his partner against EC3 and Tyrus in the final tag team tournament match of the night. Good heat. Crowd was really into Spud big time. This probably was the best thing on the entire show. Spud got more offense on Tyrus here than Adrian Neville, the NXT champion, did on Titus O'Neil this week. Think about that. Highlights were Spud slapping EC3 hard across the face in retaliation for EC3 smacking Spud around like a bully. And then later on, Spud did a cannonball dive off the top rope, out onto the floor, wiping everybody out. That was very cool. Back in the ring, Tyrus caught Spud with a choke slam. He let EC3 get the pin, and they got the victory. Main event was the contract signing for this week's big title match, coming up on Impact, big rematch between Lashley and Bobby Roode. Roode cut a promo on Lashley, putting over the importance of the TNA title before MVP cut him off. He did all the talking. Now, they've been building to a Lashley face turn now for weeks. They've had MVP constantly cut him off and do all of his talking for him. So Kurt Angle announces that he himself would be the special referee for the match, which MVP refused to accept, and he and Kenny King went to leave. Lashley, however, he went back and signed the contract anyway against MVP's wishes, so it is official. It will be Lashley and Bobby Roode this Wednesday night on Impact for the TNA Championship with Kurt Angle as the special referee. And that was your Impact episode for this week. A pretty straightforward show. Again, it's in lame duck mode right now. It's hard to get overly excited about these things. But this is a big episode coming up this week. Big championship match. I'll leave it at that. I want to mention one other thing here before I get to the mailbag and we wrap this thing up. And that is Lucha Underground. Lucha Underground is debuting on the El Rey Network this Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, so an hour before Impact. I'm not sure if Lucha Underground is an hour or 2 hours, so I don't know if it'll be in any kind of direct competition with Impact at 9 o'clock. But it's debuting this week. I saw that 4.5-minute trailer that they released a few weeks ago. It looked really impressive. The production of it looked really slick and very professional. I am hoping to see the first episode. The only problem is I have no idea how I will be able to do that. I'm sure it will probably pop up online somewhere, and if it does, that's how I'll watch it. So maybe keep an eye out. Let me know if you guys see anything, because unfortunately, my cable carrier, Cablevision here in New York, does not carry the El Rey Network. so I will not be able to watch it on television. So online is probably going to be my only hope of watching it. So I don't know if it's the sort of thing I would start reviewing on a weekly basis. It could make sense to do that, especially if Impact, you know, I think November 19th is the last regular run episode of Impact before they go into these highlight shows that are planned. That could be a good time for me maybe to start reviewing Lucha Underground if I can get into it. I mean, look, if I watch the first episode and I'm not a fan, then I won't watch it. But I'm willing to give it a shot. It does look interesting. I just need to figure out how I'm going to do that. So for those of you that do have the El Rey Network or you're not sure, check your cable company and find out. It debuts on Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. And I think everybody listening to this right now should at least give the first episode a shot, because God knows if there was ever a time that we needed something different in wrestling, this is it. I think there's already plenty of hours of wrestling on television between WWE, TNA, ROH, for those of you who watch ROH. It's not like there's not enough hours of wrestling on television, but there's not enough different kinds of wrestling. That's what I like about this. It's something different. And it's got some names that you guys would know. John Morrison, I know Chavo is part of it. I believe Ricochet is, although I think he's going under the name Prince Puma. If you've never seen Ricochet before, the guy is amazing. He's incredible. The fact that there is no major promotion in this country until now that has picked this guy up or given him any sort of serious consideration that I'm aware of, WWE, TNA, is crazy to me. I mean, this guy is incredible. So I think you may like what you see. Check it out, and hopefully I will be able to do so as well. If I am, I'll have some thoughts next week on the Sound Off. Let's move on to the mailbag now. If you have questions, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. You can also send in MP3 audio questions if you want to possibly hear yourself asking a question on the air. Cliff writes in, "It has always seemed to me that work rate was a big factor in who ROH decided to book as their world champion, but not a big factor in who was booked as world champion in WWE. For example, I can understand why Michael Elgin was booked as champ in ROH, but can never see WWE giving him that same distinction because he's so bland as a personality. On the other hand, I can see why WWE has booked John Cena as their champion, but could never see Ring of Honor doing the same because his style of wrestling is not the ROH standard. Which members of the ROH roster could you see as WWE champion, and which members of the WWE roster could you see as ROH champions? Obviously, CM Punk and Daniel Bryan are excluded. And you know what? We'll throw Seth Rollins in there too, because Rollins is a former ROH champion, and obviously he's doing very well in WWE, so we'll put him on the side as well. The first name that comes to mind to me, and one of the few, in terms of a current ROH star who I could easily see being a WWE champion at some point, Adam Cole. Adam Cole is a guy that I never used to think much of him as far as his personality and his character. You know, he was a good wrestler. I would hear about him. I would watch some of his matches on YouTube to get familiar with him, but he has really come into his own as a heel personality in Ring of Honor, and I hope he gets the belt back soon. I hope he gets the Ring of Honor championship back at some point soon. Adam Cole for sure, and I would not be shocked at all if WWE had him on their radar and brought him in next year. In 2015, I would be stunned if Adam Cole did not end up getting a tryout for developmental and then brought to NXT. Let's put it that way. So I could absolutely see him as a WWE champion at some point. AJ Styles is the other one. Technically, he is a member of the ROH roster, and I could see him being a WWE champion if they wanted him. Those are the only two. I actually went on the ROH site, looked at their current roster from top to bottom, and they've got a lot of talented guys, but those are the only two that really jumped out at me as I could see them as being WWE champion. Nobody else did. And maybe that'll change as those guys build up more of a profile for themselves, but right now, those are the two that jump out at me. As far as the opposite, what members of the WWE roster could I see being the ROH champion? You know what? In terms of main eventers, like some of the tippy-top guys they've got on that roster right now, Randy Orton. Randy Orton is, I mean, in a lot of ways, he's kind of the complete package, right? He's a great wrestler. He's got a good mind for the business. As a personality, kind of dull. He has his moments. But there's something about him. He's got that intangible that makes him almost like the complete wrestler and probably one of the best at it right now. Not the best, but probably way up there. So it's not like Randy Orton's work style doesn't jive with Ring of Honor. And he's so good that ROH, if they ever picked him up, they'd be crazy not to put the belt on him. So Randy Orton would be one. Dean Ambrose would be another. Cesaro, who was in Ring of Honor, was never a world champion, though. Dolph Ziggler. I think if Dolph Ziggler one day gets cut, they finally cut bait on him, and he's a free agent, and he goes to Ring of Honor, absolutely. And imagine the matches that Dolph Ziggler could probably have in the main event of ROH shows with some of the guys they have on that roster. So we have Orton, we have Ambrose, we have Cesaro, Ziggler. A guy like Bray Wyatt, I think, would also do very well in Ring of Honor. Not the most technically gifted guy, but good enough and plays his character so damn well, where I would have no problem buying into Bray Wyatt as champion any more than I did Homicide. What makes Homicide such a better wrestler than Bray Wyatt? You know what I mean? So I think if you have a strong enough personality and you're a good wrestler, and obviously the guy can cultivate a fan following for himself, I think Bray Wyatt and the Wyatt family would do very well in Ring of Honor. And the one other name I'll throw on that list, Tyson Kidd. I know Tyson Kidd has largely, for many years, been treated as a joke in WWE. I was very happy to see him finally come into his own as a heel character. He's been one of the more entertaining parts of NXT for this entire year. I don't watch Total Divas, but I've been told he's pretty entertaining on that show, too, and also a horrible husband. But I think there's no question about his in-ring talent. Anybody who doubts that is a fool. But I think what he's proven in the last few months on NXT, even just the last 3 or 4 months, is that as a personality, he can carry the load. I think he's been a great heel. I think he's cut good promos. And he's the kind of guy, I think, who perfectly fits that ROH mold. And like a lot of those guys back in the day that really became popular in Ring of Honor, whether it's Austin Aries, Samoa Joe, Bryan Danielson, Tyson Kidd kind of fits into that category. He's about the same size. So I think Tyson Kidd, if he ever went there, maybe they'd be hesitant just because of the fact that he spent so long in WWE as an undercard guy I don't think TNA, for example, would have any problem at all bringing in a Tyson Kidd and putting the belt on him. Ring of Honor, I think, might have more reservations about that based on the way the guy's been booked for the last, 8 or 9 years, however long it's been. But I think he'd have a shot. And I think if he got the shot, he'd be a great Ring of Honor champion. So that's my list. Randy Orton, Dean Ambrose, Cesaro, Dolph Ziggler, Bray Wyatt, and Tyson Kidd. I think those are the names that would go far and would probably make good ROH champions if they ever went over there. Josh from Victorville, with this CM Punk situation with WWE and the fans chanting his name every week and people bringing signs, which now are being confiscated by security, although they were for both very different reasons, at the end of the day, both CM Punk and Steve Austin walked out on WWE. Now WWE did acknowledge Austin leaving on TV, but that seemed to be the end of it. Now fans today chant Punk's name every chance they get, and WWE will call him a quitter. But with Austin, it seems like they were nicer about it. Why do you think WWE does not acknowledge Punk, but with Austin they did? Well, because there's way more bad blood between Punk and WWE right now. Way more bad blood. With Austin, it was pretty cut and dry. He didn't like the creative situation, and he left. And that was it. That was really the crux of the matter. And then months down the road and all the money that he was losing, they were able to kind of cooler heads prevail. They came back to the table and they negotiated a return. With Punk, it's a lot more complicated because we don't know what was discussed when Punk met with Vince and I presume Triple H the night after the Royal Rumble and then he walked out. They had a meeting. Who knows what was said? Maybe they know. Maybe Vince and Triple H, maybe they know and nobody else does, and maybe they don't know. Maybe Punk never even bothered telling them exactly why he's so pissed off, and the only person who knows is CM Punk and maybe Colt Cabana and AJ Lee, and that's it. But it seems to me like with Punk, it's not any one issue. It seems like he's just generally a very pissed off person, and he's probably pissed off about a lot of different things, and so it's hard to pinpoint exactly what set him off. And I get the impression with him, unlike Austin, he's done, and he's given up a lot of money by doing that, but he's also saved his money, and he's probably feeling pretty good physically these days. I know he was very banged up back then. Maybe that was part of his frustration. He felt like, I'm going balls to the wall here, and I'm getting hurt, and I need some time off, and they're not willing to give me that time off, so wouldn't shock me if that was part of it, too. He seems very happy going to hockey games and just hanging out and doing his own thing. And if that's the case, then good for him, but they're two different situations. The only thing similar about them is that both guys walked out. But that's it. That's where it ends. Otherwise, it's two very different situations. And the other thing also, I think, not to diminish the kind of star that Punk is. Punk became one of the biggest stars that they ever had, but nowhere near as big as Steve Austin. And I think they always knew Austin's going to be back at some point. Somebody has to blink first, and he'll be back, and we'll do business again. I don't know that they have that same impression with Punk. I mean, as a fan on the outside looking in, it looks to me like he's done, and they probably know that too. He ain't coming back. And, you know, whether there's been legal letters that have gone back and forth, I mean, there's no lawsuit or anything like that, but, you know, we've seen there's no more Punk merchandise on WWE Shop. I saw some report that in the video game even, you know, in the last game he was wearing like a CM Punk hoodie, the character, and in the new game I think it's just like a regular solid gray hoodie. So there's something going on here. There's a lot of animosity there, and it goes far beyond, I think, you know, the basic issue of I'm not happy with creative, which is why Austin walked out. So I think it's just a lot more complicated. There's a lot more bad blood there. And with Austin, they knew. I mean, they had to know he was going to be back at some point. And why burn that bridge? Anthony from Philadelphia, my question is regarding John Cena's eventual replacement on top. We can all agree that WWE needs some new blood on top, but one fact I think that gets overlooked is a big part of why Cena holds his spot is his willingness to give his life to the company. Who on the current roster do you think, or do you see, as having that same drive to go above and beyond like Cena has done? You know what? I don't know, but the whole point is you give that person the opportunity, right? Nobody knew that John Cena was going to go above and beyond until he was put in that situation. Do you think that pre-2005 or early 2005, I don't care how his work ethic may have been, nobody knew that John Cena would be willing to basically give up his entire life, his days off, to do promotional stuff and Make-A-Wish stuff. You know, I mean, maybe that guy is Seth Rollins. Maybe Dean Ambrose would be okay with that. We don't know. And that shouldn't be the only factor in deciding, you know, who's going to be the face of the company. Well, since Cena does everything, and we don't know if this guy would, let's just go back to our tried and true hand. You got to give guys an opportunity, and guess what? If they want that opportunity bad enough, they'll do whatever they're asked to do. If that means taking a day off and doing something on their day off, then they'll do it. If that means doing Make-A-Wish stuff, then they'll do it. But you don't know unless you give that person an opportunity. I'm sure all those guys at the top of the roster right now, aside from maybe a Randy Orton who, you know, maybe he's going to work less dates. I haven't seen that confirmed anywhere. I get the impression that Orton probably values his time off away from the ring. But those newer guys on the way up, like an Ambrose and a Rollins, and other guys on the roster like a Ziggler, you don't know until you put them in that position how far they're willing to go. If they've got a good work ethic, then give them a shot. And that's one of the things that they have not been doing as much of as I feel like they should. I mean, they struck gold with the Shield guys. Those guys got over, and I think they're the future of that company, but that's all well and good. Who else? You know, who else are you going to rely on? John Cena is not going to be able to do all that stuff. Even if John Cena is still around 5 years from now, there's going to come a point where he may still be around as an attraction, but John Cena will no longer be able to do as much as you ask him to do outside the ring every single week. He's going to have to slow down at some point. You better have somebody on the back burner ready to go when that happens. Who that is, I don't know. It's just whoever they give a shot to, and that could be any one of those guys on that roster right now. Anthony also wants to know, do you think WWE's recent domestic abuse policy is somewhat hypocritical because they have done and continued to do business with people that have either been convicted of or accused of domestic abuse? Guys like Steve Austin, Mike Tyson, and Floyd Mayweather. I don't think there's anything wrong with them implementing. I mean, are we really going to try to find fault in them instituting a domestic abuse policy? I think that's the one thing that we can at least look at and not criticize them for, whether it's a PR move or not. And I think they even had a spokesperson come out on WWE's part and say, we saw what was going on with the NFL, and so we wanted to get ahead of the issue before anything started on our end. Whatever their motivations were, it's a good thing to have in place. Hopefully it's a good deterrent to people doing stupid shit that they shouldn't be doing and putting their hands on women like fucking cowards. Yeah, Steve Austin had an issue once with Deborah. That was many years ago. To our knowledge, he has not had any such issues since. I mean, it was over a decade ago. Mike Tyson was a convicted rapist. He was convicted of rape in the mid-90s, early 90s. I'm not excusing it, but it was a long time ago. And guess what? He went away and he served his time. And yeah, they did business with him at WrestleMania and all that, but that was a long time ago. Mike Tyson and Floyd Mayweather are not in business right now with WWE, so I don't see anything wrong with it. I think Mayweather, in particular, is a scumbag. I mean, really read up on Floyd Mayweather. Okay, do your homework and read up on him if you're not familiar with some of the shit that he's been involved in. The guy is a fucking scumbag. But they're not in business with him right now. They did a WrestleMania match with him. He may have hosted a Raw episode after that. I don't remember. And what have they done with him since? So I don't see anything wrong with it. I think it's a good thing for them to have in place. This comes from Doug. A while back, I read Vince Russo's blog, where my condolences, where he was talking about the go-home show to Payback. And he was discussing that there were segments, three segments on the show, the Shield Evolution Brawl, the John Cena-Bray Wyatt confrontation, and El Torito getting his tail ripped off, one of the highlights of 2014, no doubt, that catered to three different segments of the audience. So each group had one segment they loved and two they either didn't care about or hated. Could WWE use their 827 different shows to cater to different demographics? They can use Raw to cater, for instance, to the casual fans that they still think watch their product. SmackDown can deliver the kind of content hardcore fans crave, and the kiddie stuff can be jettisoned to main event. Would this help the overexposure problem any? No. No, that would not work. And I mean, think about it like this. So what you're suggesting is that each show essentially have its own identity, almost like a brand split. Whether you're actually talking about a brand split or not, that's kind of the idea here. So on Raw, you say that show would cater more to the casual audience. What does that mean? What is it that the casual audience wants to see? If it's not wrestling, then what are you going to have on Raw for 3 hours every single week? Because you got 3 hours to fill on that show. Remember that. That's not going to change. Unfortunately, 3 hours is not going away anytime soon. You've got 3 hours to fill on your flagship show, and what you're saying is you're going to take away a lot of the elements that make that show what it is today and only cater to one. Only cater to one audience. Which effectively will cut down on the audience for Raw, which is not something that they want. They do not want the audience to go down any further than it's gone down in recent weeks with Monday Night Football. They always want to do what they can to bolster that rating and make, you know, get as many eyeballs on the product as possible. That's their A show. So if you're just going to have all the really long matches and good wrestling on SmackDown and not have that on Raw, you've got to have something to fill the gaps on Raw. So if you're going to have a three-hour show full of more promos and comedy and less action, that's a recipe for disaster. That's just not going to work. The kiddie stuff, okay? You say, what about jettisoning it to main event? I'd be all for it personally because all the kiddie crap I can't stand. The stuff with the Gator and Torito. I mean, thank God the last 2 weeks it's been quiet. We haven't seen that stuff. So I'd be okay with that personally, but it's for the kids' audience, right? Nobody watches main event. The kids are not subscribing for $9.99 to the WWE Network to watch Hornswoggle and Torito on main event. The kids are a part of the same audience that watches Raw, that watches SmackDown, which means you have to have something on the show that appeals to them. I would argue that most of the kiddie shit they do, even the kids, don't find it very amusing. So they just have to change that and do something else that appeals to the kids, whatever that may be. Because what they're doing now just isn't working. But you have all these different segments that are watching your show. You have to cater to them. You have to give them something they want to see. You can't just say, well, this show's going to be for that, and this show's going to be for that, and this show's going to be for that. In a perfect world, yeah, it would work that way. But you're going to cut down on your audience for each of those shows. You're going to divide the audience up, basically, which is going to cut down on how many people are watching each show, which they would be insane to do. And like I said, in the case of a main event, if you just relegate the kiddie stuff there and the things they want to see, they're not watching main event. I don't know how many people really are watching main event week to week. It's just not practical. And I don't see how that really changes the overexposure problem, because you're still going to have 3 hours of Raw, 2 hours of SmackDown, 1 hour of main event, 1 hour of Superstars, 3 hour pay-per-views every single month. You know, the overexposure is in the amount of content you have. The amount of content is not changing. You're just kind of changing what audience each show appeals to. That does nothing to change the overexposure problem. And if you're looking at it from the point of view of wrestlers who are overexposed. So I said earlier, all those guys in the main event picture right now, John Cena, Dean Ambrose, Seth Rollins especially, and it's great to see him getting a lot of TV time, but there's a difference between getting too much TV time and getting just enough. Kane, you know, they're so overexposed. So what you're suggesting then would be, in some of those cases, those guys wouldn't even appear on Raw. They would be relegated to SmackDown, or they would be relegated to Raw but not SmackDown. Again, it's not practical unless you're talking about just bringing back the brand split where each show has their own unique roster, and I'm not in favor of that either. I said for years I couldn't wait for them to get rid of the brand split. The brand split was done years ago. You know, there really hasn't been a brand split, let's be honest, in at least 5 years in WWE. Now, when they started doing it all those years ago, had they really separated the rosters, I mean, truly kept them separate, it could have worked. But they never did that. I never got the feeling like these are two very different, distinctly different shows. There was always a mixing, and then it's kind of like they reached this point where they just said, fuck it, and guys were just blatantly appearing on both shows every single week, but yet we still had a brand split. It was the stupidest thing. So when they did away with it, it was one of the best things they could have done. You know, and the idea of having brand split pay-per-views, which they did for a while, it died a death because SmackDown was always the bastard child. You would have SmackDown-only shows with hardly any star power, and they did dick on pay-per-view. That's why that didn't work. That's why they changed it to joint brand pay-per-views. So these ideas, again, in theory, they're great. In practicality, they're not. And that's the big difference. Tom is from London, England. October used to be the month of WWE's annual Cyber pay-per-view, whether it was Taboo Tuesday or Cyber Sunday. What was your opinion on the Cyber pay-per-view concept, and do you think it could be a good idea for WWE to bring it back as a pay-per-view or a Raw special at some point, and somehow use it to gain new network subscribers, maybe only allowing network subscribers to vote, for example? I think as a pay-per-view concept, it sucks, because people are not going to pay for a show where they don't know the matches. That was always the weak part of that whole concept. I'm okay with it as a Raw gimmick. You want to use it on free TV as a gimmick? Go for it. Not every single week, but every now and then for a special show, yeah, I'd be fine with that. And anyway, they want to tie in some incentives for network subscribers that might possibly get people to... Look, people are not going to subscribe to the network just so they can vote in these stupid, you know, polls. Seriously, the number of people that will subscribe to the network and pay $9.99 because of that is minuscule. But it can't hurt to try, right? Anything they could do to try to bolster that number is good. I mean, they're going to announce their new network number, by the way, this Thursday is when they're making the announcement of the latest network subscriber count. I think the number is that they're announcing is as of September 30th, so it wouldn't include any signups in the last 3 or 4 weeks. If I had to make a prediction right now, you know what, I'm not going to predict an exact number, but I'm going to predict that number ain't going to be where it's supposed to be. I think for that number to be in the 700,000 or 800,000 range somewhere would be very bad. I think it would have to be more than that to be acceptable. Anything less than the number they announced last time is an absolute disaster. And for the people who think, well, that's not possible, believe me, it's possible. I'm not predicting that's what's going to happen, but I'm saying, if that number is less, it's a disaster. If that number is still in the 700,000 or 800,000 range, that's very bad. So anything they could do to get more people to sign up for the network, they should be doing. There's a lot of things with that network they should be doing right now, but they're not. Ryan Rivera from Fort Worth, Texas, wanted your opinion on what you feel is the greatest bump or high spot of all time. Doesn't have to be just the physical aspect of the bump itself, but can include the impact of said spot on the business or career of those involved. In my opinion, I have to go with Mick Foley at Hell in a Cell with The Undertaker. I just cannot think of another spot that involved two established stars that did not have to attempt a spot that could have ended in serious injury if it had gone wrong, and how much that spot catapulted Mick's career. He said it himself, it's what he is remembered most for, and simply made him the legend that he would eventually become. I would concur, Mankind, Undertaker, Hell in a Cell, King of the Ring, 1998, the bump off the cage, really every bump in that match, but especially the bump off the top of the cage, it's a moment in time that you just cannot ever forget, and that I don't think we'll ever see again. I hope we don't ever see that again. It would be insane to ever attempt anything like that again. And it's funny you mentioned that, too, because... And by the way, just to go back to that spot, it's not just the spot itself. You talk about the impact of that spot. When Mick Foley went flying off that cage in 1998, what happened was it made it that much more difficult for every other person ever in a Hell in a Cell match to do anything that would impress the crowd. All of a sudden, it upped the bar so high that you couldn't even jump over it. And that's what kind of led into the whole TLC revolution, too, where we had these crazy matches with guys taking crazy bumps. And I'm not saying that had Mick Foley not flown off the cage, we wouldn't have had Edge and Christian and the Hardys and the Dudleys doing those matches. Maybe we wouldn't have. Maybe things would have been a little bit different. Maybe they wouldn't have been as crazy. I think they probably would have been. But he paved the way, and not necessarily in a good way, for people to top that and to do crazy shit that would get a reaction out of people. And so I think for as positive an impact as it may have had on Mick's career, maybe not his body, but his career, I think it had a negative effect on wrestling in a lot of ways because it made it impossible for people to top it. And it set the standard for what people would expect when it came to crazy stuff in big-time pay-per-view matches. Scott from Rock Hill, South Carolina. One of my favorite pay-per-views of all time is WrestleMania 10. It had everything. One of the best pay-per-view openers of all time. The very first ladder match on pay-per-view in WWF. A feel-good moment with my favorite wrestler of all time, Bret Hart, celebrating his big title win. One thing that bugs me about the show, though, is the finish of the main event. Yokozuna had Bret Hart beat, dead to rights. He was up on the second rope about to hit the bonsai drop and lost his balance. In my opinion, it made Bret Hart look like one lucky SOB and Yokozuna, the big monster heel, look like a complete doofus. It doesn't hurt the match enough for me to hate it, but I always thought that if Bret Hart were to beat Yokozuna straight up with some kind of big move, that would have made his feel-good moment that much sweeter. What are your opinions on the WrestleMania 10 main event finish? I hated it. I didn't like the match itself either. I actually enjoyed their match at WrestleMania 9 more. But I hated that finish when I saw it when I was younger, and I hate that finish now. And the thing about it is, you know, he went up on the second rope to do the bonsai drop, and Roddy Piper is the referee. And Roddy Piper and Bret Hart have a history. And so you would think, okay, maybe Piper kind of has his hand on the rope, if I remember correctly, but he's not really doing anything. And then the guy just falls. Now, it would make sense if Piper had grabbed the rope and shook it, right? And then the guy falls off. He didn't even shake the rope. He just went up like he did in every other match he ever had. And he fell, and in falling off, he just looked so stupid. He looked so dumb. I think, and of course it's easy to go back now, right? Hindsight 2020. But I think the perfect finish for that match would have been a sharpshooter. I think you had the story there 1 year earlier, WrestleMania 9, Caesar's Palace, if you remember, at the end of that match, before Hulk Hogan came out to save the day. Bret Hart got Yokozuna in the sharpshooter. He had to do it a little bit differently. He had to wait until Yoko was on his belly, and then he wrapped up those big tree trunk legs in the sharpshooter, and then Mr. Fuji broke it up with some salt. He threw salt in Bret Hart's eyes. I think it would have been cool here 1 year later to have Bret lock him up in the sharpshooter, and maybe this time Fuji is again, you know, the camera gets him going for the salt. But this time, Piper's the referee, and Piper stops it, or he gets between them, and Bret ends up getting the submission. The big monster taps out, and Bret wins the championship, and the place goes bonkers. I mean, I remember the pop that Bret got in the Garden at SummerSlam in 91 when he beat Perfect for the Intercontinental title with the sharpshooter, and Perfect was only in the sharpshooter for like 5 seconds. It's like as soon as Bret Hart put the hold on, he had submitted because his back was in such bad shape. But when he gave up and the referee called for the bell, place went nuts. And I think you would have had the same visual here had he gotten Yokozuna to tap out. And here's the referee waving furiously for the bell to be rung. The place would have gone nuts. I mean, the place went nuts anyway. It's not a big deal. But yeah, I agree with you. It's, you know, WrestleMania 10 was kind of a landmark show. That was a landmark main event with such a shit finish. I think the sharpshooter would have been the way to go there, personally. Sean from Colorado has two questions. These were pretty popular in our Facebook group, and he wanted to get my thoughts, so we'll end with these two. First, WCW did push another original besides Goldberg during the Monday Night War, Diamond Dallas Page. Heard many people say that all WCW ever produced in the main event was Goldberg, yet DDP was huge. Why is DDP often overlooked? He had a great look, and he connected with the crowd. He was the real people's champ, and the fact that WWE could not see his star power is a crime. Why was there never a Rock versus DDP match? Well, DDP was older at that point. Rock was not around full-time, although he was on his way back right around that same time. I think Rock came back for a while. It was in July, so that was only a month after DDP debuted. They could have done it. Yeah, they could have done a Rock-DDP feud. I think DDP was absolutely mishandled. I think he was all gung-ho about the gimmick, if I remember hearing him talk about it. It wasn't like, hey, they have this shitty gimmick for me, what are they doing? Like, he was all into it. But then we see what happened where The Undertaker just beat his ass and made him look like a second-rate jabroni. And he was never main event material, really ever, even from day one. He was never in the main event mix in WWE. He was always like a mid to upper mid-card guy. And I agree. I mean, they dropped the ball on him. At least get the most out of the guy when he first comes in. Even if he kind of trails off later on, if he's, you know, getting older and you want to move away from him, that's fine. Yeah, they dropped the ball on him. And yes, he was the other name that was made during that NWO Monday Night War period. It was Goldberg, and DDP was the other one. DDP was not as big as Goldberg, but he deserves credit for it, absolutely. Second question, who is most associated with each of the following title belts? And if you were on the Facebook group, you saw Sean posting photos of all the different championship belts. And by the way, let's try to be a little more careful when we spam the wall with different posts. I'm not a big fan of that, but without having the visual here for all of you, I will describe each belt. What he wants to know is what name or names do I associate with each of these belts, so I figure I'll run through this really quick. The AWA World Heavyweight Championship, was not a big AWA fan when I was a kid. I've learned more about them and watched more AWA in recent years. And to me, when I think of the AWA title, I think of Nick Bockwinkel more than I even do Vern Gagne. So I associate Bockwinkel with that belt. The WWF Big Gold Eagle Belt from the Attitude Era, when I think of that championship, I think of The Rock. That's who I think of. The ECW World Heavyweight Championship, I think of Taz, personally. The NWA WCW Big Gold World Heavyweight Championship belt, there can only be one name, that is Ric Flair. The NWA Big Globe belt from the early 80s and the 70s, I think of Harley Race. The Intercontinental Championship Classic, well, I guess the Intercontinental title design now, they went back to the classic design, which is just confirmation that that design kicked all kinds of ass because they got rid of it and then eventually they went back to it because it's the shit. It's one of my favorite championship designs, right behind the original Winged Eagle. That's an interesting one. The classic Intercontinental title look, I kind of associate three different people with it. I associate Mr. Perfect, Shawn Michaels, and Razor Ramon. Those are the three names that come to mind. I can't just... If I had to just say one, I probably would go with Razor. And he held it more times than the other guys. That's probably why when I think of it, I think of him first. And I was a big Mr. Perfect fan when he held the belt, too. He was, you know, one of my favorite Intercontinental champions to watch. If I had to pick one, I'd go with Razor, but I really want to say all three of them. And Shawn during his first heel run as well. The TNA World Heavyweight Championship, when the company was, as Shawn says, in its glory. I think of AJ Styles. That's who I think of when I think of the TNA title. The WCW World Heavyweight Championship post-Big Gold, when Flair took it to WWE. So this would have been in the early 90s, WCW. I think of Big Van Vader. I mean, the guy was a beast. He was one of the best champions that... I mean, you talk about a monster heel champion who could go. That guy could fucking go, man. I mean, he wasn't just some big fat dude that they gave the championship to because he was big or because he was fat or what. I mean, he was a big dude, but he could go. He made it look real. Probably because half the time he really was beating the shit out of his opponents. But find me another guy like him as agile. Find me a guy like him that'll go to the top rope and do a fucking moonsault. You talk about people who don't get enough credit. I don't think Vader gets enough credit. And you talk about a Hall of Fame guy, a guy who should be in the Hall of Fame right now. I think of Big Van Vader. So when I think of that belt, I think of him. The WCW US Championship, I thought about this. I don't really associate it with any one guy. If I had to pick one, maybe Lex Luger. because he held it so many times. He held it like five times, I think. So Luger, I'd go with by default, but when I think of the U.S. title, there isn't any one guy that pops into my head. The WWF Winged Eagle Belt from the Hogan to Austin era. Who do I associate that with? I associate that with two guys. Hulk Hogan's the easy answer, especially since I grew up on him. Hogan, absolutely, without question. If you put a gun to my head and said you can only pick one, it's Hulk Hogan. But I also associate that belt with Bret Hart. Bret Hart, to me, did a fine job, I think, of representing that belt as the top guy and having classic matches. And yeah, I think of Hogan and Bret are the two guys when I think of that original Winged Eagle belt. And lastly here, the WWE Undisputed Championship from 2002. I think of Brock Lesnar. I think back to that time period, I think of that belt. I think of that belt around Brock Lesnar's waist, and he wore it well. So that's going to wrap up the mailbag. I did say I'd have some thoughts, like a quick review on See No Evil 2 at the end of the show here. There isn't much I can say, really, without giving spoilers and ruining it for everybody. So I'm not going to do that, but I will say this. If you are into horror movies, slasher movies, brainless slasher flicks, you'll probably like it. I think I enjoyed the first movie more than this one. This one was, I can't even really say it was that good. It really wasn't that good. I just kind of enjoyed it for what it was, but it wasn't like when I was done watching it, it had satisfied my personal criteria for what makes a good horror movie. I'm not even sure what that criteria is. I just kind of know it after I've watched a movie. And I watch a lot of horror movies. I've seen a lot of slasher flicks. This one kind of falls into the category of, okay, it's just kind of there. It's not really that good. It's not horrendously bad, but I wouldn't necessarily go out of my way to see it unless you're really that big of a Kane fan and you want to see his movie, then by all means, go ahead. If anything, it may have been a little disappointing because it had Danielle Harris in it. Now, Danielle Harris is awesome. She's in these kinds of movies. You won't find her in any major motion pictures. I mean, she was in the Halloween adaptations that Rob Zombie did. She's also the young girl who was cast in Halloween 4 and 5 back in the day, the older Halloween films, if you remember them. I think she was also on a TV... What TV show was she on? Was it Roseanne that she was on? I don't even know. Here, I sound like the Danielle Harris biographer now. But I like her work, and she's awesome. She's like the new Scream Queen. Oh, the Hatchet movies. That's what it was. There was a series of low-budget horror films called... there was one called Hatchet. Did well enough. They brought it back, did a Hatchet 2. When that does well enough, what do? You bring it back a third time. And the main villain in that movie was this guy, Victor Crowley. He was kind of in the same vein as Jason Voorhees and Freddy and Michael, where no matter what you do to the guy, he just keeps coming back. He just never dies. I liked it for what it was. I enjoyed the Hatchet movies, and I enjoyed her performances in there. So knowing that she was in this movie, when I heard that they brought her in to be in, I was all excited. And she is one of the more enjoyable parts of the movie. She's not bad to look at either, so that doesn't hurt. I mean, with her, she's hot, she's got a sense of humor, and she's an admitted horror geek. I mean, really, what more could you possibly ask for in a woman? So she's enjoyable in the movie. There's another actress, and I don't have her name offhand, and I see people saying how she was the best part, she's so hot, she should have had more of a role. Maybe it's the way that she looked in the movie. I didn't see anything really appealing about this one. I got to find her name. I'm going to look it up right now. Give me a second here. And again, I'm not trying to insult her. Catherine Isabel. That's her name. She played Tamara, was the character in the movie. Catherine Isabel. I'm not familiar with her. I don't know what else she's been in. In this movie, I didn't think she looked that great. She didn't do anything for me. Actually, I found her character to be the most fucking annoying of any in the film. There was one other guy, though. There's one of the other main characters in the movie is this guy Seth, who's kind of the love interest for Danielle Harris's character, Amy. Now, here's the thing. I looked at this guy in the movie, and there was something about his face that I knew him from somewhere, and it was annoying me. Like, half the movie, I just couldn't stop thinking, like, where do I know this fucking guy from? It was bothering me. And I waited until the movie was over, and then I went on the IMDb page, and I saw his name was Kaj Erik Erikson. And I clicked on his bio, and I looked at his photo, and I saw what he had been in, and I realized that's how I know him. And it's such an obscure reference. Some of you may get it. A lot of you won't. But many years ago, back in the mid-90s, there was a television show on ABC called The Commish that had Michael Chiklis in it, who was in The Shield, which came many years later on FX, my favorite all-time show ever, right up there with Breaking Bad. And on The Commish, he played this fictional head of a police department somewhere. And he had a wife, and he had a son. I think he might have had a young daughter. This guy was the son on The Commish. I mean, talk about an obscure reference that I'm probably the only person in the world who was bothered by this. But it was just like gnawing at me. And then I saw that, and I felt very proud to have known that, in fact, I do recognize the guy from somewhere. But I haven't seen... What it also made me realize is I haven't seen him in anything else since The Commish. And his next big claim to fame is See No Evil 2. So I don't know if you can call that a good career or not, but nonetheless, that's where I knew him from. So that's my take on the movie. The plot line is pretty basic. I mean, it picks up from the night that the last movie ended, where it looks like Jacob Goodnight, which is the character that Kane played, is seemingly dead. He's being transported to a morgue, and obviously he's not dead, and a lot of chaos and carnage ensues, and who's going to survive, if anybody? That's kind of what you are left to wonder. So that's See No Evil 2 in a nutshell. Kane is fine. The only problem is, in watching this film, the only thing I could think of whenever Kane was on screen was corporate Kane. I was waiting for him to make a match and interfere and shit. And he did interfere and shit. And when Kane in the movie interferes and shit, he kills people. So maybe he could start doing that on Raw. He could come out and kill bad segments. That could be his gimmick. One last reminder, I will be a panelist on the Straight Shoot podcast this Monday, immediately following Monday Night Raw. That's tomorrow night, for those of you listening to this on Hell in a Cell Sunday. Head over to AubreySitterson.com for all the details. I'm sure I'll post links out about all this stuff on Twitter and Facebook as well. I will be on along with one of the top writers for Marvel Comics, Jason Aaron, so I am very much looking forward to that. And don't forget to check out the interview I did with Aubrey, which is up on our YouTube channel right now. You can follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. I'll be live tweeting, as always, during the pay-per-view tonight, Raw tomorrow night. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster is my profile page. We also have a closed discussion group on there. You can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com and show your support for the show. But you can also sign up for an Audible trial, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. We have another week left here in the month of October to pad our numbers a little bit more. And you can check out all of the shirts, 10 different t-shirt designs now up in our store on prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. All different sizes, they ship internationally, and most importantly, for those of you who are a little leery about PayPal or don't use PayPal, can't use it, they do now accept payments via credit card and debit card. So you have no excuse to pick up a t-shirt, 10 different ones to choose from. Buy more than one. The more the merrier. That's going to wrap up episode 351, this Halloween edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Thank you very much for tuning in. We will be back next weekend with a brand new show, episode 352. Check out my Hell in a Cell review, which should be up on YouTube later in the day on Monday. And thank you, as always, for all your support. I really appreciate it. So be well, stay safe this Halloween, and we will see you right back here for a brand new episode next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Happy Lee. I had to sit in the stands and watch Granny break a wine bottle over another woman's ass. What a classy lady. And I loved how she went for the cheap pop by pleading with everybody,
"My mother was born in Brooklyn."
As if that's supposed to impress all of us. Guess what? It didn't. They got exactly the reaction they deserved. And the next morning on the Today Show, they talked about their experience. Kathy Lee claimed that she was against appearing on the show in the first place. She had to be convinced to do it. This is all coming from a woman who once made an autistic kid cry on national television. There's a lot of dumb shit this woman has said over the years that should have earned her a lifetime ban from television. She's got no business being on TV. Why is she employed? Why does she have a job? The picture of class, Kathy Lee Gifford.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.